Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Direct from our newsroom in Washington, in color, this is the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite and Russ Hodge in Memphis, Tennessee, Dan Rather in New York, Bernard Kalb in Saigon, Marvin Kalb in Wellington, New Zealand, and Bert Quint in Khe Sanh, South Vietnam.
Good evening. Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. Police have issued an all-points bulletin for a well-dressed young white man seen running from the scene. Officers also reportedly chased and fired on a radio-equipped car containing two white men. Dr. King was standing on the balcony of a second-floor hotel room tonight when, according to a companion, a shot was fired from across the street. In the friend's words, the bullet exploded in his face. Police, who have been keeping a close watch over the Nobel Peace Prize winner because of Memphis' turbulent racial situation, were on the scene almost immediately. They rushed the 39-year-old Negro leader to a hospital where he died of a bullet wound in the neck. Police said they found a high-powered hunting rifle about a block from the hotel, but it was not immediately identified as the murder weapon. Mayor Henry Loeb has reinstated the dusk-to-dawn curfew he imposed on the city last week when a march led by Dr. King erupted in violence. Governor Buford Ellington has called out 4,000 National Guardsmen. And police report that the murder has touched off sporadic acts of violence in a Negro section of the city. In a nationwide television address, President Johnson expressed the nation's shock.
America is shocked and saddened by the brutal slaying tonight of Dr. Martin Luther King. I ask every citizen to reject the blind violence that has struck Dr. King, who lived by nonviolence.
Dr. King had returned to Memphis only yesterday, determined to prove that he could lead a peaceful mass march in support of striking sanitation workers, most of whom are Negroes. Dr. King had this to say last night about the situation in Memphis.
Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over there. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest for right.
There was shock in Harlem tonight when word of Dr. King's murder reached the nation's largest Negro community. Men, women, and children poured into the streets. They appeared dazed. Many were crying. A young Negro said, Dr. King didn't really have to go back to Memphis. Maybe he wanted to prove something.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, April 28th, 2017. So I have been told this is our fifth study session on the late Mrs. Coretta Scott King, her autobiography, My Life, My Love, My Legacy, as told to Reverend Dr. Barbara Reynolds. We are picking up on chapter 14 in the text. The opening segment lets you know where we will arrive today. Also today, welcome Felicia Rashad. I think we had folks before who looked at the audiobook and saw that there are more multiple narrators listed, and Felicia Rashad is listed as one of the narrators. And if we've listened to a good chunk of the book so far and know Felicia Rashad, that will change today. Stay tuned. With that, we will go ahead and get started. Folks can remain alert if you have any notes that stand out, things you would like to share. Let's keep our ears open, listen closely, take good notes. Context of White Supremacy, again, Mrs. Coretta Scott King, her autobiography, My Life, My Love, My Legacy, audio segment number one.
14. Moral concerns know no geographic boundary. Shortly after our Selma campaign ended, Martin told me, "The doctor is always telling me how badly I need a vacation, so come on to the Bahamas with me." We were still in the process of getting our new house in Atlanta renovated. We had scheduled the movers months ago. There was no way I could pick up and go as quickly as Martin wanted. "I'm leaving on Sunday," he told me, "and I want you to come at least by Wednesday." So the movers came on Tuesday. My friend Freddie Henderson and I stayed up all night putting up curtains, decorating, and trying to get things in order. We didn't want the house to be a mess when Martin and I returned from the Bahamas. In my mind, I was thinking, how can I get all this done, put everything in place, and still be with Martin? I bet people might be saying, "Oh, look at that woman running after that man." Yet I lived with the terrible reality that our days together were numbered. I knew that sooner rather than later I would not have Martin, and I didn't ever want to feel that Martin had asked me to do something I did not do. I was willing to make whatever sacrifice I could. It was hard, though. That Tuesday night I received only 1 hour of sleep. At the end of the day, I felt as I did the first day I marched in Selma. My legs felt disjointed, like they were coming apart from the hips, and I was so tired. Still, the next morning, I dropped everything anyway and took off, leaving all the unfinished business behind. As an admitted perfectionist, that was difficult for me. Yet it was astonishingly easy for me as Martin's soulmate and wife. We had a lovely and rare getaway to the Bahamas, and when we got home, it was right back to business. In 1965, Martin made a dramatic shift in the movement, from south to north, from the battleground of the Bull Connors and Jim Clarks to the plantation of Chicago's mayor, Richard Daley. In keeping with Martin's style of leadership, which chose to challenge the worst examples and draw them into the public eye, Chicago became the SCLC's next target. Its towering housing projects loomed like upright concentration camps, placing abject black poverty within sight of white opulence. These visuals, combined with the deep despair of many of the impoverished blacks, made the city an ideal challenge. Switching gears proved more difficult than we could have ever imagined. The black community was spread out over such a large area. It was not as tightly knit in the north as it was down home, which meant there were many more factions to pull together. Moreover, we had never gone up against a sophisticated political machine, one much more devious than what we had experienced at home. Martin's primary goal was to prove to naysayers that nonviolence could work in a tough and gritty urban context. His mission was to dramatize the conditions of the black poor, to create an understanding of their plight among the powerful, to equip blacks to change their conditions, and to bring whites and blacks together in a spirit of cooperation. In Chicago, Martin decided to live among the least of them and rent an apartment in the ghetto. I agreed to pack up the kids and move with him, since we did not know how long the campaign would take. Martin arrived in Chicago first in January. I joined him once he'd found an apartment, and we planned to bring the children in at the beginning of the summer. In all my life, I had rarely seen anything like the conditions we faced in Chicago. The level of poverty called to mind our travels through Bombay a few years before. Our apartment on the west side, among the poorest of the poor, was in a dingy building that had no lights in the hall, except for a single dim bulb at the head of the stairs. There were no locks on the front door. Drunks came in and used the hallway as a public toilet, so it always smelled of urine. Our apartment was on the third floor, up three sets of rickety stairs. The old refrigerator didn't work, neither did the dilapidated gas stove. The heat didn't work, and sometimes it felt as cold inside as out, with temperatures that often dropped below zero in the winter. As we became friendlier with our neighbors and were invited into their apartments, we learned that as bad as our accommodations were, others had it even worse. On the third floor of one building, we met a family of 10 who were crowded together in a tiny apartment with no heat or running water. I had never seen such depressing conditions, but no matter how miserable we were, we understood that our suffering could not be compared to that of those who lived permanently in the housing projects and had little chance of escaping or improving their lot. Our rent was $80 monthly, which was more than the whites paid in nicer areas in the suburbs. What exploitation! Poor blacks were trapped in a vicious cycle. Redlining by white real estate agents and selective covenants restricted them to concrete ghettos where education, medical services, and transportation were grossly limited. Few educational options led to unemployment, which in turn forced many blacks to opt for welfare to feed their families. Those on aid could not own property, not even an automobile. This policy ultimately confined the trapped ghetto dwellers to jobs near their homes, limited though they were. Prices for food and clothing around the ghetto were also hiked up, intensifying the financial exploitation and ensuring the confinement of project residents to the bottom rung. Our children's arrival was delayed when James Meredith, who had been the first black student to integrate the University of Mississippi, was shot and wounded by a white man during a march in Mississippi. Martin flew to Memphis to see James in a hospital there. Then Martin and Stokely Carmichael and a number of others restarted James's march from the spot where he had been shot. When they reached Tougaloo, Mississippi, 15,000 black people were gathered there, the largest such gathering in Mississippi history. Yoki and Marty and I joined Martin to march from Tougaloo to Jackson. James Meredith had recovered enough to join us as well. After that march, we took all four children up to Chicago with us. We had some furniture by then, some bought secondhand and other pieces that had been donated. Although we lived as simply as we could back in Atlanta, our way of life in the South was totally different from life in the ghetto that summer. There was nothing for the children to do except go outside the apartment building and play in the black dirt. There was nothing green anywhere. Even the playground was black dirt. The moment they were dressed and went outdoors, their clothes were soiled. And when I tried to keep them inside, their tempers flared. There were shouting and pushing matches, which didn't happen often at home, where they had plenty of room to run off their pent-up energies. The Chicago Freedom Movement's first big rally and demonstration, which had been in the works for more than a year, was planned for July 10, 1966, at Soldier Field. An unprecedented 45,000 people showed up. We took all four children to the platform, including Bunny, who was only three. Mahalia Jackson sang. There were speeches, and then Martin read his list of demands for social justice in Chicago. The demands were of real estate boards, banks, the mayor, the city council, the Chicago Housing Authority, politicians, businesses, unions, the governor, the federal government, and of the people. This was a Sunday, so of course City Hall was closed. Still, Martin led that enormous crowd to City Hall and nailed the demands to the closed City Hall door, just as his namesake Martin Luther had done with his 95 theses centuries ago in Wittenberg. The march was a beautiful, nonviolent demonstration. We had planned to allow our three older children to march with us, but when Bunny heard her sister and brothers talking, she started asking, "When are we going to march?" And when the speeches were over, she said, But we haven't marched yet. I said to Martin, what are we going to do about Bunny? And he replied, let her march with us. He was particularly unable to resist her wishes in those days. So even though she fell asleep and was carried more than half the distance by Bernard Lee and Andy Young, Bunny marched with us, and that was the only time our family ever marched together. I wish we had thought to get a picture of it. The next evening, before a mass meeting, Martin and I went to dinner at Mahalia Jackson's house, and after dinner, on our way to the meeting, we ran into our first riot. The outbreak had started when police turned off fire hydrants that young people who lacked access to swimming pools were using to cool off. The youths started throwing rocks and breaking windows, and then the gangs got involved. Several black youths were beaten, others were arrested. Two gangs, the Cobras and the Vice Lords, threatened to tear the city up if the prisoners weren't released. Martin, Andy Young, Bernard Lee, Mahalia, and I all went to the police station, and Martin persuaded the authorities to let us post bail. That night, angry crowds milled in the streets. SCLC staff were out all night trying to calm things down. Our children were safe on the other side of town visiting some friends of ours, which enabled me to be out on the streets for most of the night with Martin. The next day at noon, I addressed a women's meeting at the YWCA on the predominantly white north side. I had been up nearly all night and was depressed, depleted, and completely exhausted. I proposed that 100 women sign and send a telegram to Mayor Daley supporting Martin's proposals. Initially, some were reticent about signing because their husbands held jobs with the city. I pushed the point, saying, "What are you afraid of? The time has come when we have to make a decision and make a choice." After that, they signed the telegram. They also decided to form a permanent organization called Women Mobilized for Change. It was an integrated group and eventually grew to 1,000 members. That night, our whole family stayed with Mahalia, and the day after that, the children and I returned to our apartment. The next night, Wednesday, July 13th, Martin was addressing a mass meeting on the west side, and I was going to speak to a group on the north side, taking the children with me because I didn't have a babysitter. While the children and I were getting ready to go, we heard glass shatter in the street. The children, who were looking out the window, saw some boys breaking a plate glass shop window and shouting, "Black power." That was when it hit us. We were in the middle of a riot. People arrived to take us to the meeting on the north side. I was addressing the group, with the children, including an overtired and restless Bunny, on the platform alongside me, when I was interrupted by someone saying there was an emergency call from Martin, who had heard about the rioting near our apartment and was worried about us. He and I promised to stay in frequent communication by telephone, and I took the children back to the slum apartment that night. It was a nightmare. We traveled back through more glass breaking and through more shots being fired. The rioting went on for most of the night. Eventually, we went to bed, listening to the shooting. Needless to say, it was a frightening experience. Soon after the rioting ended, I took the children back to Atlanta. As a family, we had spent only a few weeks in Chicago. Meanwhile, the SCLC changed its focus in Chicago to concentrate solely on demonstrations for open housing and an end to economic exploitation. There was tremendous resistance to these efforts. Bricks and bottles were thrown at Martin and his aides as they marched through the lily-white suburb of Marquette Park in a push for open housing. Some of the same type of people who had confronted us in Selma and Birmingham confronted us as we marched in that Chicago suburb. Swastikas and Nazi flags waved. Someone hit Martin in the head with a rock, which brought him to his knees, although he was not seriously injured. He told me, "I've been in many demonstrations all across the South, but I can say that I have never seen, even in Mississippi, mobs as hostile and as hate-filled as in Chicago." Finally, on August 26, 1966, the Chicago movement came to an end. The SCLC, Mayor Daley, the Real Estate Board, and the Chicago Housing Authority inked an agreement on open housing. It did not live up to its promise, however. As soon as we left, city officials continued to do business as usual. That said, there were at least two lasting victories. In 1962 in Atlanta, the SCLC had established a program called Operation Breadbasket, which aimed to take the movement to the next level in its fight for equal economic rights. Now that we were able to get on the bus, we needed to be able to afford the cost of the ride, or even to own the bus company. In Chicago, starting in 1966, Operation Breadbasket, under the able leadership of the Reverend Jesse Jackson, pushed for job promotions, business opportunities, and an end to economic exploitation of the poor, such as the supermarket chain's practice of selling inferior products at exorbitant prices in the ghetto. In addition, some of the gang members we lived and worked with put down their guns and dependence on violence and marched with us, using nothing but their bodies and their faith to protect themselves against the evil of their enemies. Despite the Daily Machine's unwillingness to honor its commitments, I believe the seeds of nonviolence and direct action we planted, along with our challenge to decades of entrenched economic exploitation, have produced a rich harvest that lingers to this day. Personally, I saw Chicago as a first step in spreading our wings. We broke out of the box and moved beyond our southern borders. The northern drive was not without its critics, of course. There were those who believed we should not have stepped beyond the Mason-Dixon line. To the contrary, I say that moral concerns and matters that prick the conscience know no geographic boundaries. After receiving the Nobel Peace Prize, Martin also began to talk more about carrying the philosophy of nonviolence beyond American soil. In 1965, at an SCLC retreat, Martin asked me to make a general statement about why we should take a public stand against the Vietnam War. I talked about how it would continue to drain resources from education, housing, health, and other badly needed social programs. I said, "Why do you think we got the Nobel Prize? It was not just for civil rights. Peace and justice are indivisible." Still, the Reverend Otis Moss of Cleveland was the only SCLC board member who encouraged Martin to support peace in Vietnam. All the other members argued that his position would dry up donations to the SCLC because an anti-war stance would upset too many whites and make us appear unpatriotic. For the next 2 years, Martin agonized over his silence, quietly working behind the scenes on anti-war public policy, raising his concerns about the war in private meetings with the president and in a meeting with UN Ambassador Arthur Goldberg, where Martin called for a halt to the bombing of North Vietnam while more peaceful diplomatic efforts were pursued. In the meantime, since the spotlight shone so brightly on Martin, the press overlooked my agenda and activities, which had been deeply pro-peace and anti-war since my days at Antioch. I was called upon to participate in a number of anti-war campaigns. For example, in 1965, Martin and I were invited to speak at a major rally in Madison Square Garden protesting the Vietnam War, and while Martin decided not to attend, I participated. In fact, I was the only woman and one of only two blacks invited to speak. I also continued my affiliation with Women's Strike for Peace, the group I traveled to Geneva with in 1962 on a peace mission. Until 1967, Martin had been content to leave it to me to march, protest, and mount public challenges to the war in Vietnam. With my history of anti-war activism, it was easier to assuage his conscience about not being more strongly involved himself. We were always a team, so he felt that, well, at least one of us is involved. In March 1967, Martin led his first anti-war march in Chicago, and a few days after the march, he made it clear through the press that he had marched as an individual, as a clergyman, as one who is greatly concerned about peace, and not as the leader of the SCLC. Then on April 4, 1967, he gave a speech at Riverside Church in New York City to a large gathering of clergy and laymen. It was entitled Beyond Vietnam, and was one of the most courageous and prophetic speeches he ever delivered. He pointed out that if America's soul becomes totally poisoned, part of the autopsy must read Vietnam. He noted that African Americans were dying in disproportionate numbers in Vietnam and called it a reflection of the Negro's position in America. We are taking the black young men who had been crippled by our society and sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they have not found in Southwest Georgia and East Harlem. Martin knew what would happen once he took this position. Virtually every major newspaper in America, including much of the black press, lambasted him. Members of Congress, his fellow civil rights leaders, and brethren of the cloth joined the parade of criticism, accusing Martin either of not sticking to the civil rights struggle or of aiding communism. SCLC funds did suffer. Friends such as Roy Wilkins blasted him publicly. But his answer was this. Cowardice asks the question, is it safe? Expediency asks the question, is it politic? And vanity comes along and asks the question, is it popular? But conscience asks the question, is it right? And there comes a time when one must take a position that is neither safe, nor politic, nor popular, but he must do it because conscience tells him it is right. In spite of the opposition, Martin took part in the Spring Mobilization for Peace in New York City on Saturday, April 15th, 1967. When the march was announced, I told Martin, "Finally, I will be able to march with you. All these years I've been marching for peace alone, or as the only black, and certainly the only woman." But Martin said, "I want you to go to the West Coast and lead that one. They need you out there. I will be on the East Coast." I told him how much I'd looked forward to being with him, but in the end, I went to San Francisco, where I was needed. About 60,000 people participated in the San Francisco March, and about 250,000 participated in the New York March led by Martin. After the march, the criticism against Martin's pro-peace views grew even stronger. But he was merely practicing what he had often preached, and what we both believed. If you have never found something so dear and so precious to you that you will die for it, then you aren't fit to live, he wrote. 15. I don't want you to grieve for me. In the early months of 1968, Martin was terribly distressed. I had not seen him like this before, and it was heartbreaking for me. When he became depressed, I could usually find the words to help comfort him, to lift him out of the depths of his discouragement. But now my words took root only for a moment. Since 1964, riots had been breaking out in urban cities across America each summer. Harlem and Rochester and Philadelphia in 1964, Watts in 1965, seven major riots across the country in 1966, and then in 1967, 159 race riots across the country. Hundreds were injured. Scores were killed. Each summer, as the temperatures started rising, so did tempers, anguish, and rage. Usually the root cause was police brutality, but sometimes it was a lack of jobs. Sometimes the cause was not easily understood. Martin and I felt that if the rioting continued, America would either fall into the throes of anarchy or become a right-wing police state. Of course, neither was acceptable, and Martin felt that something had to be done to steer the nation away from this deadly intersection. While he condemned the violence, he also understood that moral and economic issues lay at its root, issues that America might not have the resolve to fix. During each of those harrowing hot summer days, Martin took the rioting to heart. It was so like him to be his own toughest critic. Here he was, a prophet of nonviolence, watching as values entirely opposite of his moved to the forefront. The movement had accomplished so much. Civil rights bills had passed, schools, lunch counters, and housing were being desegregated. But maybe it wasn't happening fast enough. So little time, so much to be done. If the riots continued, there would be only more bloodshed, and Martin worried that people would give up on nonviolent protest and direct action campaigns in response. In those times of desperation, I prayed for him. I kept trying to find the right words, ones that would help him see past the cities in flames and connect with the millions of people who had faith in him and were convinced he was their best hope. When I could make him stop in his tracks and look at me, I would hold him and say, "I believe in you." I would see the spark coming back into his face, but still, he agonized. Not only did he agonize, he was haunted. Martin was haunted by the faces of poverty that he had seen in rural Mississippi and in the ghettos of Chicago. He had left Chicago, but Chicago wouldn't leave him. Far too often he had seen little children with clothes too skimpy to protect them from the city's harsh winds. A closer look revealed mucus in the corners of their eyes, a reminder that although they were surrounded by some of the finest medical centers in the world, vitamins and flu shots were luxuries their families could ill afford. Martin had seen an apartment where rats attacked a baby in his crib, a scene that spoke to the flimsy, filthy housing conditions in a state we like to call Up South. In Mississippi, too, Martin replayed searing images in his mind, ill-clad children sitting in one-room schoolhouses without books or lunches, malnourished in a state where corporate farmers were receiving billions not to plant food or cotton. The problems of the poor were invisible. Out of sight, out of mind. Martin wanted to make the plight of those in the lower classes visible to the world. He wanted to dramatize the hidden face of American poverty. We believed that just as segregation was immoral in a democracy, poverty was immoral in a nation as wealthy as the United States. Fortunately, as Martin and the SCLC were mulling over the issues of the poor, Marion Wright, later Edelman, founder and president of the Children's Defense Fund, helped Martin make a way out of no way, as the gospel lyrics promise. Wright, an attorney, was director of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund in Mississippi. She visited Martin in his Atlanta office, bringing with her four black farmhands, men who had been jobless since the government farm programs began paying farmers not to grow crops. Wright proposed that Martin and other religious and labor leaders lead a protest in Washington with a sit-in and fast at the office of the Secretary of Labor, W. Willard Wirtz. The plan was to protest until the problems of the chronically unemployed were addressed. As Martin and the SCLC mulled Wright's proposal, the fast and sit-in were thrown out, but the concept of dramatizing the extent of poverty in America seemed workable. The effort would be called the Poor People's Campaign. It would not be solely about blacks, but would include Puerto Ricans, Native Americans, Mexicans, and poor whites. The prospect of establishing a rainbow coalition that could eventually see beyond racism and challenge the systems that demeaned all persons excited Martin. The overall objectives were economic security, decent sanitary housing, and quality education for every American. The planning team decided to focus on 10 cities and 5 rural areas. Martin threw himself into these efforts. It was not unusual for me to awaken before daybreak and see him at his desk, deep in thought, or scribbling notes on a yellow legal pad. I knew he was getting little sleep, but he seemed like a man with no time to rest. It was as if he were racing against a clock, one that was ticking off precious minutes all the while. The faster he ran, the faster the clock. Martin performed as if a great force were driving him onward, forcing him to find solutions to the problems that tormented him before time ran out. He and I both felt tragedy moving swiftly toward us. It was a sensation I'd had for years, but it had recently become more intense. Ever since the Montgomery bus boycott, the heat of terrorism had been bearing down, stalking us. It felt like just yesterday that terrorists bombed my front porch with me and our baby Yoki in the house. I suffered through Martin being jailed, through his being taken, handcuffed and chained, in the back seat of a police car down dark Georgia roads, places where black men and women had no doubt been lynched. I had answered countless phone calls to hear someone threatening to kill Martin, me, and our family. We knew that FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover had labeled my husband a public enemy, a threat to the United States of America. How could we not know we were living on borrowed moments? Death was something that neither of us welcomed, but it did not paralyze us either. Guided by the writings of the Apostle Paul and the life of Jesus, we knew that Christians are often called by God to participate not only in the victory of a risen Christ, but in his agony and his suffering. Martin sometimes even placed himself in the historical context of Jesus, especially when he said he would be crucified for his beliefs. As he told me, "If I am crucified, remember to say, 'He died to make men free.'" He also told me, "I probably don't have a long life ahead of me, but if I die, I don't want you to spend your time grieving. You go on and live a normal life." In an effort to build support for the Poor People's Campaign, Martin went on a series of what we called people-to-people tours to recruit poor persons from across the nation for a peaceful demonstration to be held that summer in Washington, D.C. Everywhere he traveled, people came in large numbers to hear him and to pledge their support. Martin also came up with the novel idea of having a lowly mule train go from Marks, Mississippi, which was in Quitman, the poorest county in America, to the nation's capital. I thought the campaign was actually the most difficult project the SCLC had ever attempted to organize. Instead of mobilizing a city, we were mobilizing a nation. There was scarcely a power center that our campaign would not touch. On March 10, 1968, I went to the press conference at Atlanta's Pascal's Motor Hotel, at which the Poor People's Campaign officially launched. In January, I'd had surgery to remove fibroid tumors. I was supposed to recuperate and stay off my feet for about 3 months, but I felt an urgent need to press on and attend the news conference regardless, and to continue my efforts to personally record and document important events. Leaders of about 70 non-black groups representing Puerto Ricans, Mexicans, Native Americans from reservations, and poor Appalachian whites were at the press conference that day, countering the criticism that we were planning an all-black crusade against the economic power structures of America. Cesar Chavez, the co-founder of United Farm Workers, was ailing and sent a representative. Wallace Mad Bear Anderson spoke for a poor Iroquois confederation from upstate New York, and Peggy Terry, reportedly raised by a Kentucky KKK family yet now a member of CORE and SNCC, was also there. Despite this diverse group of fired-up people who had traveled across the nation to the heart of Black Atlanta to address an American problem, the press coverage was negative, as I'd anticipated. Now that the movement was showing enough muscle to unify protesters across a broad spectrum of ethnic and economic groups, we had become the enemy. We were opposed not only by much of the media, but by members of Congress and some of the Johnson administration, although LBJ himself had been very supportive of our past efforts. As I attempted to rest in the wake of my surgery, Martin decided that he too would take a short break. The doctors had been ordering it. He knew he needed a rest, and everyone around him agreed that he was pushing himself too hard. Sometimes he would keep his inner circle, Andy, Bernard Lee, and Ralph, up until 4 a.m., probing and pushing for the correct course of future actions. Andy once wondered aloud if Martin had declared a moratorium on sleep. At the suggestion of his doctor, he finally decided to take a short vacation. On March 12th, right before he left, he phoned me from his office and asked, "Corey, did you get the flowers?" "Not so far," I told him. He explained that he'd gone to a florist and picked some out especially for me. I eagerly awaited their arrival, and indeed, as he returned home to pick up his bag to go to the airport, the flowers arrived. They were beautiful red carnations, but when I touched them, I was surprised to discover that they were artificial. Martin had never given me artificial flowers before. It seemed so unlike him. That night, I complimented him on their beauty, but asked whether the florist had picked artificial flowers by mistake. It was not a mistake at all. "I wanted to give you something that you could always keep," he said. Those red carnations were the last flowers I ever received from Martin. Did he have a premonition of what was to come? I will never know for certain, but the flowers certainly suggested that he did. They were his prelude to goodbye. When he returned from vacation and refocused his energies on the Poor People's Campaign, a garbage workers' strike in Memphis grabbed our attention. On February 23rd, a small, peaceful march by the Sanitation Workers Union Local 1733 of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, AFSCME, was broken up by police officers using clubs and mace, the squad cars charging in like a cavalry. This outraged not only blacks but some whites as well, including the predominantly white AFL-CIO labor union. At the invitation of Jim Lawson, who headed the SCLC's Memphis affiliate, Martin agreed to lead a protest march on March 28th. Before the protest, however, on March 23rd, Martin took advantage of an opportunity to take Marty and Dexter on a people-to-people trip through rural Georgia. Whenever he could, he tried to include the children in his work. We wanted them to have an understanding of his commitment and the cause he championed. As much as I wanted them to take the trip together, I do remember how worried I was when they were late returning. My concern was complicated by their flying in a small chartered Cessna. When they finally arrived, 4 hours behind schedule, the boys were exhausted, though flying with their father and hearing the crowds applaud him was hugely exciting for them. Martin was also exhausted, but after putting the boys to bed, he immediately went back to work. Increasingly, he seemed to be trying to fill every waking hour with something productive. In retrospect, I think that trip was one of the greatest gifts Martin could have given the boys. I am sure it was Martin's hope that they would freeze the memory and carry that picture of their father's commitment with them for the rest of their lives. It was like a snapshot of his character. After all, Martin had no money to leave behind. All he could implant in their consciousness was an outline of his character. On March 28th, Martin went on to Memphis as planned. I was in Washington, participating in a press conference with the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. In my statement, I discussed the ways in which the Vietnam War, which I had been very vocally against, was negatively contributing to the urban crisis. Social programs for food, housing, and health were being raided to foot the cost of an ever-expanding war. The situation appalled me. Shortly before I boarded the plane for home, I called our Washington office to touch base. As soon as I said who I was, a staff member told me that violence had broken out in Memphis while my husband was leading the march. I needed to know if Martin was all right, so I called Reverend Walter Fauntroy, who headed the Washington office. "Yes, he's fine, but he is terribly depressed," I was told. I felt relieved, but I also knew how badly Martin was hurting. He abhorred violence, and I knew that he would be blaming himself. Later that evening, Martin told me what had happened. He and Ralph arrived late to the march, which had attracted about 8,000 demonstrators. The unrest had already started when they arrived, and almost immediately Martin sensed that something was wrong. His staff had not taken time to perform the nonviolence workshops that customarily preceded a march, and he saw black power signs scattered throughout the crowd. There was no proper lineup, and Martin told me he could sense a lack of discipline. As it turned out, things were worse than he thought. Some of the younger black nationalists from a group called the Invaders had threatened to tear the place up if their agenda did not receive immediate attention. Martin said he soon heard the sound of breaking glass, followed by shouts and screams. In the distance came the sound of sirens. People were running in all directions. Martin said he yelled to Lawson to cut off the march because it had turned violent. Ralph, Martin, and Bernard Lee were spirited away by a black woman driving a Pontiac. She took them to a Holiday Inn near the Mississippi River. When Martin turned on the nightly news, he saw that the scene was pandemonium, a mini-riot. As I'd guessed, Martin was extremely despondent. "I feel responsible," he told me. "This is terrible. I can see the headlines now. Now we will never get people to believe in nonviolence. The national press was unrelenting in its berating of Martin for the violence and in its declarations that the era of nonviolence had ended. An editorial in the Memphis Commercial Appeal stated flatly, "King's pose as the leader of a nonviolent movement has been shattered." Much later, however, we received confidential information that the youthful invaders who were at the root of the trouble had been infiltrated by the FBI, which used them to discredit my husband. It seemed that Hoover had vowed that King would never have another peaceful demonstration. Memphis offered an opportunity to prove it. At that point, Martin felt he had no choice but to return to Memphis and lead another march to prove the efficacy of nonviolence. That march was scheduled for April 8th. Although he sounded so very low that night, a feeling that showed at the evening press conference, the next morning I learned that he'd had a miraculous turnaround. A different Martin appeared. The fire was back. The words and ideas flowed again. I understand he did a yeoman's job explaining to the press what he thought had gone wrong, in defining the frustrations of the black leadership and restating his commitment to nonviolence. Bernard Lee said, "I had seen him in a lot of press conferences, but rarely was he as profound and eloquent." One perplexed reporter who had been to the earlier press conference noticed the change and asked, "Dr. King, what has happened to you since last night? Who have you talked to?" Martin answered, "I have only talked to God." On April 2nd, Martin met with the SCLC staff and reiterated his belief that a peaceful march in Memphis was key to a successful Poor People's Campaign. The meeting was very lively. It was a little like the Last Supper, at which Christ told Judas that he would betray him and spoke to Peter and the rest of his disciples. Most of the staff were not supportive of Martin's going back to Memphis. They felt it was getting in the way of their bigger project, the Poor People's Campaign. When Jesse Jackson continued to press his objections, Martin barked at him, "If you're so interested in carving out your niche, go ahead, but for God's sake, don't bother me." The meeting became heated, and Martin got upset, but it ended well with a decision to go to Washington by way of Memphis. On April 3rd, Martin prepared to return to Memphis on a 7 a.m. flight. Ralph came over to pick him up at our home. As was usual when Martin traveled, I rose early to prepare breakfast, but neither Ralph nor Martin ate. I followed Martin to the door, kissed him goodbye, and wished him well. The children were still asleep and didn't see him leave. It was an ordinary farewell like thousands of others. As always, Martin promised to call me that evening. We later learned that Hoover had leaked a story to the local media in Memphis, deriding Martin for staying at the Holiday Inn, then considered too fancy for a black leader. Martin, ever sensitive to criticism, checked into the black-owned and operated Lorraine Motel. As promised, Martin called me that night. He explained that although Memphis Mayor Henry Loeb had obtained a federal injunction against the march, he was going to lead it anyway. He told me that he was going to address a mass meeting that night at the Mason Temple. Then Martin said, "I'll call you tomorrow." In one of those inexplicable ironies of history, he wasn't feeling well that night and decided to let Ralph speak in his stead. When Ralph arrived at the Mason Temple, the headquarters of the Church of God in Christ, about 2,000 people had gathered, rather than the hundreds expected, given there was a violent rainstorm raging. A tornado had also been sighted in the area, but even such inclement weather couldn't keep the people away. The congregation was cordial, but Ralph sensed they were hungry for Martin. He called him at the hotel and explained the situation, asking Martin to come and address the waiting crowd. My husband's entrance in the giant hall at Mason Temple created tremendous excitement. Cheers and applause rang out as he walked in the door and down the aisle to the pulpit. Instead of the standard introduction, Ralph took the time to do a lengthy, rather unique summation of Martin's life, from birth to his present involvement in Memphis. Then all eyes focused on Martin, and he spoke for nearly 2 hours without notes. He gave his "I've been to the mountaintop" speech, which hit such high notes of oratory prowess that it can be compared to Lincoln's Gettysburg Address or the farewell address of George Washington. Martin spoke solemnly about the fate of prophets, which had not changed much from the Old Testament era. Most of the biblical prophets and disciples of Christ met tragic ends. Even in his agony, though, Martin's concern was still for the masses. "I've seen the promised land," he told the gathered throng. "I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord." When he finished, there was hardly a dry eye in the church, including for Martin himself, who was overcome with emotion. Earlier, he'd had me copy out several stanzas of the Battle Hymn of the Republic, which included "His truth is marching on," the line he'd planned to use as a conclusion. Caught up in the inspiration of the moment, he forgot to deliver the line. In that speech, he also spoke about me, about how we had traveled the Jericho Road together in Israel. He connected our travel to that of the Good Samaritan, who picked up a wounded man who'd been beaten by robbers. Most of the others traveling by considered what would happen to them if they stopped. But the Good Samaritan asked, "What will happen to him, the wounded man, if I don't stop?" Martin said that this was the question we must ask when considering the plights of others, like the striking sanitation workers. What will happen if we don't stop to help them? Better than anyone else, Martin knew what those who loved him could not bear to contemplate, that his time on earth was not long. Without being morbid, he tried to prepare his family, his friends, and his congregation. On February 4, 1968, at Ebenezer, he had preached "The Drum Major Instinct," a sermon that had always seemed to me the most fitting eulogy for him. In those days, the SCLC had a national radio station that broadcast the speech, and I had a staff member make me a copy. One evening, my sister Edith and I settled back in my home to listen to it. When we reached the part in the tape at which Martin talked about his funeral, Edith, who loved Martin dearly, shook her head. "Corey," she whispered, "Martin is definitely not going to be with us long." Usually I was quick with an optimistic retort. This time it seemed I had run out of words of hope. I did not answer my sister. I merely pretended not to hear. On the afternoon of April 4th, I took Yolanda shopping for an Easter dress, having bought the boys Easter suits the Friday before. I had not been home very long when the telephone in my bedroom rang. It was 7:08 p.m. For most of our married lives, Martin and I knew that one day there would be a scene like this, a moment that would take one or both of us away from the other forever. But no matter how many times you rehearse it, it never feels real until it happens. The caller was Jesse Jackson. "Coretta, you had better take the next thing smoking. Doc has been shot."
Context of White Supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. This is audio segment number one of Coretta Scott King's autobiography, My Life, My Love, My Legacy. If you have thoughts, observations, questions that you would like to share, the number to dial 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. That number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If you do not want to use your phone, you can use the free VOPE line to dial in. That is linked. The address you need, it's linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tiny, T-I-N-Y.cc tinyurl.com/oneRace. And that is the number one. The address again, tiny, tiny.cc/oneRace. And that is the number one. When you put in that address, click the link on the left of the page. It'll say free vote line. When you click that, it'll open a small window on your screen. On the top line, select the number that I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. Next line, it will ask for the code. That code, 564943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can put in a real name, nickname. You can press random keys. Once you get all that information entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the live broadcast. You should be able to hear us. If you are interested in participating, it's the same procedure. Press star 6. You'll see the dial pad on your screen. When you do so, press 1. You'll hear the audio prompt. I will see your hand on the screen, and we can get you on the line. Folks that have commentary, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Feel free to share any thoughts, observations, questions. Let's see. All righty. Got that one.
That one. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. The thing that I really appreciate about this book is the way that she presents her activism in light of being the husband of Dr. Martin Luther King. You know, most people would just probably pass her off as, you know, oh, she's just the wife of Dr. King, but she was an activist, you know, before she even met King, and did her activism work while she was with King, and probably even if she wasn't married to Dr. King, she would still probably be recognized as one of the leading activists of the civil rights movement. So this is something that I really appreciate this book about, tells more about it. When she mentioned about the riots uptick in the late 60s and all of it being the root cause of police brutality, it vividly reminded me of some of the things that have been going on in the last couple of years now with Ferguson, Baltimore, and, you know, all of them being the root cause of, you know, police brutality as well. So goes to show you how much things haven't changed much from back then up till now. When she mentioned about the minister shunning Dr. King after his stance, anti-war stance against Vietnam, it kind of reminded me of something here in Chicago that wasn't mentioned in the book about when Dr. King first got here, there wasn't many black ministers that greeted him. And matter of fact, many of the black ministers weren't very happy to see Dr. King, mainly because most of them were controlled by Mayor Daley. So I think maybe two or three ministers were supportive of Dr. King in Chicago. She used the word when she was describing the bombing, the bombing of her house. She used the word terrorist, which is very, you know, very accurate in that definition. Most of the time when you read about bombings back then, they don't use the word terrorist, but she used it, and I appreciate that. When she said, when she spoke to Reverend Fauntleroy about how Martin was terribly depressed, it goes to show you the psychological effects that white terrorism has. I'm pretty sure he's seen, Dr. King has seen much white terrorism, and even to the great Dr. King, it can get to him psychologically, you know, and leads to depression, you know, especially when you're a guy like Dr. King who tries to, you know, is an anti-racist who is trying to do things battle white supremacy. So, you know, we have to, you know, be mindful of that too, when we, you know, when we confront, you know, white supremacy and white terrorism in that fashion, to make sure that, you know, we're in our right mental mind and state, even though the conditions don't are not conducive to it. So I'll stop there for now. If we have time, I got some other things, but I'll mute my line.
Yes, sir. Glad to hear it. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if we have not heard from you, proceed.
Can I be heard?
I heard both Mr. Demery Ford and retired firefighter in Florida.
Doesn't matter. Mr. Demery Ford, you can go.
That wasn't me.
Oh, my apologies, Mr. Demery Ford. I guess the other male that spoke up, did you want to go?
Oh, okay. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Greetings, everybody. 2812 from Virginia. I don't even know where to begin. When Ms. King was talking about the conditions of Chicago and the poverty and the pissy stairway, I grew up in New York City. I did not grow up in the projects, but I had many acquaintances that did. And for, I just know for a lot of non-white people, sometimes they hear those conditions and they think that they're not real. And they're very, very real. And also, I really like the fact that she compared it to a third world country. And I just think that a lot of the white people know what the conditions are, but I think a lot of black people still, for some reason, don't believe that we don't live in these conditions anymore, where that's, you know, the total opposite of the case in every urban city. And I really found that interesting. Another thing I thought of was when Gus was speaking in The Warmth of Other Suns, and how, you know, for some reason, a lot of people can't understand why young black males in particular turn to crime and sell drugs because white supremacists have created these environments. I immediately thought about what Ms. King was talking about with her own children and how when she put them in that environment, they got very angry, and she said she's never seen them behave that way. And I think that it would be correct to say that all across the world, the system of white supremacy has created non-white people, specifically black people, everywhere you look, where you have poverty, where you have deprivation, there's a lot of frustration, and you see those behaviors. The last thing is, you know, just hearing her talk about her relationship with her husband, it actually made me even shed a little tear. A lot of black self-respect there, but, you know, it's 2017, and, you know, Miss King had to feel that, you know, had to feel that same phone call that, unfortunately, many a black mother has had to feel last year with the people that died in Charleston, the same deal, and it's just, you know, it just makes you want to take this problem extremely seriously, and it's a wonderful book, and that's all I got, guys. Thanks. I'll be in my line.
Good to hear from you. Other folks who have a hand up that we have not heard from, please proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I took a lot of notes, so I'm gonna try to go real, real fast, and it's based on what I heard with the first half reading and things that I've studied along the way also. Dr. King, he would come periodically to Miami a few times and via him going to the Bahamas, and they stayed at a famous Hampton House. It was called, which is almost in every area. Black people had problems with accommodations, and there's normally maybe one hotel that was owned and operated, or at least operated by black people, and where you can have some sort of comfort when you're out of town. Number two, I have down here Dr. King's Earnest to Solve. problems of racism. He made errors, but he was honest and very sincere. And I thought about that when I was thinking about Chicago. Chicago's projects were some of the worst living conditions in the world. I've seen them for myself. Number four, the protests, I have down here, the protests of racism became more shows than substance. Of course, the activity is not enough to neutralize the system of racism, white supremacy. He also led a real large march in Detroit, I think maybe a little bit before, and we know how Detroit is right now. I'm not blaming it on him. I'm just stating the fact about, you know, these large protests that seems to still have non-white people, non-white black people especially, interested in to be around a whole lot of people. I got down here, I would indeed think that white women were not in support of this is King and counter racism, especially with housing, especially in Chicago. And I'll have down here also, Mayor Daley did not budge on significant issues facing black people that I know of, unless somebody can tell me something different. I would say that I have down here also, I would say that although this is an autobiography, for the most part, you know, just about in every paragraph, she mentions about her husband. Maybe she feels she has to, I don't know, but she does mention herself, but she also mentions her husband in almost every paragraph. The speech at Riverside was, in my opinion, his most poignant speech on race or white supremacy, and that doubled with his ability to influence victims of racism may have increased the plan to kill him. I think I have down here a lot of black youth respected Dr. King for his honesty and his courage, but he did, in my opinion, he did not influence a lot of black youth after 1964. You know, when he started going in the North as well as even out west. He was out there at one point in time at Watts, and it was like, I guess because, you know, maybe the age factor or something like that, you know, it could have been that, or they just weren't, they weren't feeling Dr. King, you know, but they respected him and respected him for his sincerity and courage. I believe today's technology would have made their marriage a lot more tougher than what it actually was. Based on how the FBI and their technology back during that time and the technology that they have now, some of the things that we learned about and read about 30, 40 years after the fact, probably be on ABC News, you know, that sort of thing. And that would have made it very, very, very tough on Mrs. King and her family. The lesbians and the homosexuals adopted the Rainbow Coalition. They called themselves Rainbow something. I can't think, I suspect that they adopted it from non-white black people's effort to solve the problem of racism and white supremacy. I admire Mrs. King also for her courage and her patience. That's what comes to my mind when I think of her, how very patient she was, and her courage, of course, because just about everything, every danger that her husband went through, in a lot of cases, she also was in the same dangerous environment. If not, somebody would have came at her. Because that happens a lot to damage a person. They may not damage that person personally. They may go at somebody they really care about. So she should be identified for having, you know, same amount of courage. Mrs. King said the white union members were in support of the black garbage collectors, but I have out here, but it wasn't enough to overpower the practice of the Memphis mayor, the racist practice of the Memphis mayor, and even the salary, even the salaries amongst the workers. These were some of the exact problems on why they did walk off the job, and also the ability to neutralize, basically, that's the sum of it, neutralize racist white supremacy. The Lorraine Hotel I have down here was equivalent, like I said, to the Hampton House. Dr. King and the Battle Hymn of Republic, he did use it in the Selma to Montgomery speech, which the man probably was his most rousing speech that I can think of, and that's what he quoted in the last part of that speech. And last but not least, I can remember what I was doing when Dr. King, when it was announced that he was shot. We were eating dinner at the time. I was in the fifth grade. And that's all I have for right now. Thank you.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. Other folks that we have not heard from at all. If you have commentary, proceed.
Yes.
Can I be heard?
I heard Mr. Demery Ford and the other male caller as well.
Go ahead, Mr. Demery Ford.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Demery Ford here. Greetings to Gus, the other callers and listeners. In chapter 14, starting out, she was talking about their trip that they took to the Bahamas and taking a mental holiday. Because fighting white supremacy produces stress on black people, and it's important that we take some time out to replenish ourselves and to maintain our mental stability. She also spoke about them moving to Chicago and renting an apartment. And she used the phrase, among the least of them. I think that was probably taken from, you know, a phrase taken from the Bible. It's a lot of religious references in her book. But living on the third floor, having to walk up those stairs, no heat, people urinating in the hallways, and paying at that time $80 in rent, which was quite a bit of money, probably be equivalent to, you know, let's say 800 or 1,000 now. But it was more than what the whites were paying in better areas. And then not letting whites off the hook, a lot of them were the landlords, the Jewish and other whites owns those buildings and let them deteriorate. Because they just didn't care. There was a mention of James Meredith being shot and the speech or his at Soldier Field. It was a freedom rally, you know, where he was asking for open housing, quality transportation, jobs, tenant rights. All these very important issues, and a demand list was made and put on the door of City Hall. You know, and like the firefighter said earlier, Mayor Daley, you know, although they came to some compromise, they never fulfilled any of those promises that they made. And she mentioned how they had tremendous resistance against people mobilizing, you know, for human rights. And that's white people, you know, holding black people back, resisting them from, well, they were the cause and then stopping black people from achieving some degree of human rights. She spoke about the race riots you know, in all of the major cities. And you can see that all these disparities that was facing black people, why you would be angry like that. And police brutality, part of it. And I think that, you know, all of that violence and race riots was probably responsible for the Civil Rights Bill getting passed, more so than peaceful marches. She mentioned the phrase, she said, out of sight, out of mind, when she was talking about the poor people, when they started their poor people campaign. And that would be, I would take that phrase as if the way whites view black poverty. You know, of course, they're not there. They don't care whether you're starving to death, you don't have a job, rats is in baby cribs. They could care less. I think that when he started the Poor People campaign, and started bringing other non-white people together in search of housing, education, jobs, you know, that probably accelerated his demise even as much or maybe even more than the Vietnam, the protests against the war in Vietnam. And she mentioned taking the kids on, well, he took his sons on a march. It's important that we teach the young people about struggles that black people have had for human rights, and that they don't get sidetracked into thinking that all this, you know, just came about because of the benevolence of white people. And one last thing, when he moved his, he had planned to stay in Holiday Inn, and then they moved him to that Lorraine Motel. Hoover had something to do with that. I think the FBI was part of that. They already had that shooter in place. I visited the Lorraine Motel. I went over to that building. I looked right through that bathroom window where James Earl Ray took that shot. And it's one last thing I want to say about the Lorraine Motel. It's a lady that sets out in front of that. She's been protesting for, I don't know, 15, 20, maybe 25, 30 years. And she just sits there every day with a sign. I went over and talked to her. And, you know, I guess with everything that's going on, she, the only thing I could get out of it, she does not like the fact that they've turned all this into some type of profit, you know, enterprise, where they got everything that James Earl Ray wore, his car, his suit, his underwear, everything is in this museum. And it's just, I don't know, it seems to be overkill to me, but I'll mute my line on that. Thanks, Gus, for taking the call.
For sure, for sure. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, commentary you would like to share, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings, Gus, the rest of the callers and the listeners. This is Jay out of New York. Still a great read. This book has actually really, my thought process around Dr. Martin Luther King and the whole movement was very different, kind of coming in from how I learned about it in school. Also how I attached it to white supremacy itself and seeing how it kind of brought us to where we are today. But this book has really kind of like placed me into the day-to-day, which kind of helped me connect back to the individuals that were in place. So just want to commend Dr. King and Mrs. King for huge Black self-respect, and I think a couple of the callers mentioned it earlier, just in reference to that activity when they moved to Chicago, looking to be in the Chicago area and living in the projects. I grew up in Brooklyn, and Like our earlier caller, I didn't live in the projects myself, but all of my friends did, so I was there a lot. And those activities, just like she mentioned it in Chicago, I mean, it's widespread. So no matter where you go, it's the same. It's like a staple, no matter what project area that you go into. So to live there themselves, and then as an attempted parent to take their kids there, and have their kids experience that, knowing that their kids had the comfort of, you know, being in the South and the outdoors, definitely speaks to their wanting to be a part of that movement. And as she mentions a lot in the book, that they wanted the kids to be a part of that movement with them. Really, I would just say just tons of Black self-respect in reference to that. And also just seeing how things continue to be the same way today. So when the white folks are ready to change those conditions of these areas, they gentrify, and these same locations that were just deplorable turn into these great areas that have every aspect of luxury that you could think of within a 6 to 8 month period. So just amazing how things that are talked about during that time frame, as we look at it today, really remains just the same. On page 147, I'm just going to read the quick little paragraph here. That said, there were at least two lasting victories. In 1962, in Atlanta, the SCLC had established a program called Operation Breadbasket, which aimed to take the movement to the next level in this fight for equal economic rights. Now that we were able to get on the bus, we needed to be able to afford the cost to ride the bus, or even to own the bus company. One thing that I've continually heard, and when I listen to the movement, they don't speak about companies, and Dr. Claude Anderson speaks about this all the time in his lectures. His family owned a bus company, and I think they had like multiple lines running in the South. And one of the things he always speaks about is the fact that the bus boycott, after that, they were forced out of business because all of the non-white patrons preferred to ride the white bus, white-owned buses, after the movement. And I kind of liken that to what's happening today, that there's this economic push to get over the hurdle. Once we get over the hurdle, it's going in, and no matter what the treatment is coming from the white individuals, we're going to still patronize and let our communities kind of fall into this to this area of not being able to sustain itself. So looking at how the connection even during that period, and it also brings a connection to, is that why they allowed that to happen? You know, in terms of having that movement pushed to that level, because they do speak about, as Mr. Demery Ford mentioned, that there are certain things that they penned in ink to go through, and nothing changed, and it was business as usual. But the things that they wanted to make change, like the bus boycott and things of that nature, they did, but they benefited from it by making money off of the non-white. So just putting a lot of things together and really finding it informative. So that's all I have for now. I'll meet my line.
Right on. Other folks that dialed in who have a hand up, did you have commentary?
Can I hear it?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, hi, thank you. I really like the book. I'm glad I turned in. I like the part where they talked about Hoover not liking him too, or Coretta Scott, and how he really made this big deal as if he was a main threat and a number one terrorist. Called him a communist because I watched some programs on Netflix about American history. And they were, if you just look in his face, he was just real adamant. It's just like that was a main problem, Martin Luther King Jr. And regardless of if he was violent or not, his agenda, anybody, that is not what he wanted us to do, any of the stuff that Martin Luther King was doing, or even think about that. So that was interesting. And how they still do it now. They kind of demonize and make it seem like you're anti-American if you go against the mistreatment. And with Coretta having the fibroid tumors, and then it made me think back to medical apartheid and the Henrietta Lacks, and what do they really do with our cells when they tell us that we have fibroids, and because that's a lot, and then they take your uterus, and you know, we know about Henrietta Lacks, but how many others have they done and not told us that they're living? And they take a lot of our uteruses or fibroids and all that. They do it, it's quite often with us telling us that. But I'll mute my line, and thank you for taking my call.
Yes, ma'am. Other folks, anybody we missed who has a hand up, commentary they wanted to share that we have not heard from? Got everybody? Okay. We have more time. We still have about 20 minutes or so. So please do not wait till the last minute if you think you do have something that you would like to share, question, comment. Before I even get to some of my direct comments from the book, since the text was mentioned, and it is one of Gus's top five books all time, and the author happens to be extraordinarily gorgeous, Isabel Wilkerson, still angry I missed her when she was here in Seattle recently. She talks extensively about the Black migration and specifically Chicago. That's a very important city in the Black migration. She talks about Dr. King's experience in Chicago. One of the main characters, Ida Mae Gladney, I'm sure Mr. Demery Four remembers her. She went to hear Dr. King give one of his speeches in Chicago. She talks about, you know, him bringing his family there and staying and everything. One of the great anecdotes, since Mahalia Jackson also has been mentioned in the text, but one of the great anecdotes from The Warmth of Other Suns, Miss Jackson moved to Chicago as well, part of that migration. Isabel Wilkerson writes, "It happened to ordinary people, and it is terrorism. Black people moving into various parts of Chicago had their houses bombed, just like Birmingham, just like what you heard from Coretta Scott King happening to her multiple times, terrorism. So it happened to ordinary people like Ida Mae Gladney and to celebrities like Mahalia Jackson, the leading gospel singer of her day. When she began looking for a house in a well-to-do section of the South Side, Chicago, people held meetings up and down the block. A Catholic priest rallied his parishioners and told them not to sell to her the religion of white supremacy. You'd have thought the atomic bomb was coming instead of me, the singer said. She got calls in the middle of the night, I feel like I heard that before, warning her, you move into that house and we'll blow it up with dynamite. You're going to need more than your gospel songs and prayers to save you. She bought the house. It was a sprawling red brick ranch in the house of her dreams, coming as she had from the back country of Louisiana. A doctor had broken ranks and sold it to her. As soon as she moved in, the neighbors shot rifle bullets through her windows. The police were posted outside her house for close to a year. One by one, she said, they sold their houses and moved away. As fast as a house came on the market, a colored family would buy it. Even Hyde Park, an island of sophistication just north of Ida Mae's working-class neighborhood of South Shore, succumbed to the same fears and raw emotion that overtook the rest of the city's South Side. Shall we sacrifice our property for a third of its value and run like rats from a burning ship, said a handbill circulated among white residents trying to keep blacks on the other side of State Street? Or shall we put up a united front to keep Hyde Park desirable for ourselves? I'll stop there, but it's very extensive. I thought that was a great passage from the book, because I would almost say, even with all the detail and everything in this book, I would say it's still kind of mild with how ugly things were in Chicago, and probably on the whole. I think many people have said it would be, the half has never been told. I think that is apropos. I think that is why he, Edward Baptist, titled the book as he did, that it would be difficult to accurately write all of the horrors of white supremacy. And even if you could, you probably would not want to read such a text. But I definitely got that feeling this week. I felt that at a few points before, but I felt it definitely. And it might just be because I know a little bit more detail about some of the things that happened in this. We've read Warmth of Other Suns. Some of the books that we've done in the book study have covered this. So, yeah, but I felt that this week. Moving back to the text, some of the main things that stood out for me. I thought it was great, Dr. King noting the disproportionate number of black people that were dying in the conflict in Vietnam. Actually, I can go all the way back and do it chronologically. I thought it was great. I think one of our callers pointed this out previously, that they were paying, the black people were paying higher rent for horrendous living conditions, higher rent than what white people were paying for outstanding quality of residential housing. That is a trend that's covered extensively in The Warmth of Other Suns. Beryl Satter, family property. She is a suspected race soldier. She was a guest on this program. Talks about that extensively as well. Ta-Nehisi Coates Pete's about reparations. He's written about that extensively. We've talked about that a lot on the program. Continues. You can even think about that with the recent insurance information that was released about black people paying higher insurance rates. Let's see. They mentioned the legend, James Meredith. Dr. King said that he had just the highest regard for the courage of James Meredith, as do I. Another brilliant illustration of black self-respect. Let's see. Just the black dirt, I think many people, I think Thomas in New York and others have noted. I think Mr. Fuller as well have noted that areas where racists want to warehouse black people, no green. Like, that's how you know, oh, that's where the Negroes are. No green, no grass, no trees, no flowers, nothing. Just dirt. And I think she emphasized it here, black dirt. I thought Mr. Fuller, I was reminded of him a few times when they go to Chicago and Mahalia Jackson, they go to Chicago and he says, Martin read his list of demands. The Godfather, you make demands. You're going to do this or, you know, maybe you won't be around for the next holiday. You know, like, that's when you make demands. If all you're going to do is sing songs or whatever, you don't have the power to make people treat you correctly, get, you know, what it is that you want. You're not making demands. You're just making requests. I view that as just, you know, being accurate, being logical, and making sure that we use the best terms when we talk about things, particularly we talk about racism. I already got my Mahalia Jackson in. I thought it was really important when she was talking about they were trying to get their petition together, and she said initially some were reticent about signing because their husbands held jobs with the city. Oh man, you will run into that a lot even in 2017. That's what the system of white supremacy means, and being honest about that. Can't make demands if I'm afraid if I go in here and get too uppity. That I might get a pink slip tomorrow. And that happened to a whole lot of black people. I mean, throughout the world. But I mean, that is well documented. Black people, if you just went to an NAACP meeting, you didn't have to be a member. You didn't have to be protesting, talking about kill whitey or black power. None of that. Just went to a meeting. It was there and boop, got you on the list now. You could be denied loans, lose your housing, lose your job, all kinds of things. This is documented. Continuing. I thought there was, seemed like there was a point of emphasis a few sentences down where they're talking about their effort. They say they formed a permanent organization called Women Mobilized for Change. This is in Chicago. It was an integrated group. I feel like that means there were white people present. I feel like sometimes that in and of itself becomes a goal, to have white people present as though that represents progress. White validation, Thomas might say. Let's see. And same, I feel the same sentiment later on when Dr. King, or she's talking about Dr. King being hesitant to speak out publicly in opposition to the Vietnam War because it might upset white people. I think that is a problem as long as the system of white supremacy exists. Non-white people being in positions where we're dependent on racists for a job, for funding, for, you know, our basic needs. And you don't want to say anything or do things that might get them especially riled up in opposition to you. I think that that is a problem as long as the system of white supremacy exists. Let's see. It connected, I think, directly to why a lot of what they call the black press. And I'm a big fan of talking about the importance of black journalists. And they have done such tremendously important work, and particularly during this period. But the same problems. Black journalists then and now struggle with financing. And so I suspect directly or indirectly, they too are dependent on white people for financing. If white people get upset with the articles that they're publishing, you might not have funding to stick around. And that has happened to a lot of black journalists as well. I thought it was really, really important. This is from chapter 15. I don't want you to grieve for me. Felicia Rashad is coming up, by the way. I said it at the beginning. Stay tuned. Where they're talking about the quote-unquote riots that were happening throughout the country at the time, where she says, Martin and I felt that if the rioting continued, America would either fall into the throes of anarchy or become a right-wing police state. This, again, in my view, is just about being accurate with terms. I don't know what is meant with the term anarchy. That's one of those terms I don't have a clear definition about, and it's a term I don't use. But I know system of racism, white supremacy. I know we do have that. And anarchy could be said to be white supremacy. If you're being terrorized every day and your house is being bombed, that sounds like anarchy to me. Police state, she just said or wrote, I mean, literally two sentences before she writes, America would either fall into the throes of anarchy or become a right-wing police state. Two lines up, she said, each summer as temperatures started rising, so did tempers, anguish, and rage. Usually the root cause was police brutality. That to me sounds like we already got a police state. If we got to have a march every other day about Sandra Bland and Michael Brown Jr. and Jonathan Farrell and Eric Garner. Okay, we already got police state. That's what system of racism, white supremacy is, in my view, just being accurate with terms. Let's see. Last few things. Terrorism, I appreciated that as well. I thought that was really important that she referenced all of this as terrorism. I agree. And she's done that repeatedly in the book. I think we've made note of that a few times, her use of the term terrorism. speaking of terrorism, where she said, I'd answered countless phone calls to hear someone threatening to kill Martin, me, and our family. Wow. Again, these are the type of things that I think are important to think about, pause, and reflect on before we get upset with another victim of racism just because, well, I don't agree with your view. You know, I don't like that you said police state or, you know, anarchy or whatever. Or I don't like that you got an integrated organization. Sounds like you kind of soft on white people. So I'm gonna call you names or, you know, talk bad about you. Well, at least let me pause. You are still a victim of racism, white supremacy. You have VGQ, and you are being subjected to terrorism just like I am. I don't have to agree with everything you say. I don't even have to find you, you know, pleasing to be around. But I can at least say I'm going to be courteous. We can disagree and what have you, but I'm still going to be courteous, and I'm still going to recognize that you are a victim of white supremacy. I'm going to try and be as patient with you as I can. You already touched on it. We had William Pepper on the program, who has done extensive work on this. He was an attorney with the King family. I was going to say, I am of the opinion that the alleged assassin of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., James Earl Ray, that might not have been him. White people can give an array of stories and narratives, particularly when they have killed a non-white person who is trying to solve the problem of white supremacy. They can concoct an array of fabrications so that you don't, you know, figure out quite exactly what happened. And it seems like they have a pattern of doing that sort of thing, particularly in this period, the 1960s. I think William Pepper, his several books, Mark Ling, the book he co-authored with Dick Gregory, Murder in Memphis, same conclusion that they came to. They had a big trial about the government's involvement in this. I'm of the opinion that this might not have been James Earl Ray at all. Even Walter Cronkite said that they were firing on a different vehicle with several white people in it. They even said that. I mean, immediately, that's what I appreciate. If you can get things live time, sometimes they will slip and give some extra details that'll be important moving forward. Last comment I'll get in, and then we can double check. I know folks said they had other comments, or if anybody wanted to respond to anything I've said or have questions, feel free. Dr. Kenneth O'Reilly, I think Mr. Dimrefour mentioned his book last week, Nixon's Piano. His book as well, Racial Matters, the FBI Secret File on Black America, 1960 to 1971. Another great book about their tactics when you have things like this happening. Dr. King trying to lead a nonviolent protest for the sanitation workers in Tennessee. And the invaders come in and mess everything up. Dr. O'Reilly's work, I think, would go a long way to helping to understand that. And it's easy. You can even think about that in today's context. Ferguson, just, you know, we were talking about before. And my final comment, where she says we didn't learn this until years later about the invaders. Again, we are not experts on racism. White people are way more informed about racism, white supremacy. Non-white people are finding out 10, 20, 30 years later about ways that we were terrorized and racists ruined our lives deliberately. I'll stop. Other folks that are with us, did you have additional comments, questions? Feel free. Oh, wait a minute. We have people making sure we don't miss anyone, anyone that has a hand up that we haven't heard from at all. Okay. If other folks have commentary, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I'd just like to add on a little bit more about the Vietnam, his efforts to speak out on Vietnam. Another motivating factor was, her husband, Dr. King, didn't always, wasn't being followed by a camera or something like that, or being documented. And sometimes he was able to approach the average everyday person or people. And it is one occasion, I believe I read it somewhere, it was in Bedford-Stuyvesant, if I'm not mistaken, in New York. And he was on a street corner, and some young people, black males especially, were talking to him on a street corner, and he was basically trying to convince them about, you know, nonviolence as a quote unquote strategy, and basically they patiently listened to him. And one of the young persons said, well, Dr. King, what about Vietnam? In other words, all of these young black males were eligible for the draft. And in most cases with black males, they would have been 1A, meaning that in that time, I've talked with plenty of non-white black males who were around in that era. And you 1A, you almost guaranteed to be sent to Vietnam, the Republic of Vietnam. And instead of him still trying to debate and argue the subject, he grew quiet. It was said he grew quiet and listened to those young people. You know, in other words, you want us to be nonviolent over here, and we're going to be forced to be violent against, as Muhammad Ali said, people who didn't call me never called me nigger. Non-white people on top of that. And that was, from my understanding, was another motivating factor. That that particular incident was another motivating factor for him to speak out openly on the quote-unquote war in Vietnam. That's it.
Right on. Did other folks have commentary? Other people have other portions they wanted to dissect, questions they wanted to pose? Nothing else in particular stood out? Right on. Make sure I didn't have anything left I wanted to get in, and then we could get to the second audio segment since we stopped at such a riveting point in all of this. Let me see. I might be satisfied. I think I at least hit most of the main points. I did want to make sure I got in. I have been to Chicago, and I would concur. They do have the areas where they warehouse black people in Chicago. Yes, they are very, very gruesome, have been for a long time. And that's why I say I think that's important. I've said that consistently. If you look or if you listen right, you hear when people talk about how things are so bad in Chicago for black people. It's been like that, you know, for eons. I mean, we did that program with Pam a short while back and just talked about some of the history of things that have happened in Chicago as it relates to racism, white supremacy. And they have terrorized black people in that area for as long as black folks have been there. Any time for black people in Chicago is horrendous. Dreams from my father, former President Barack Obama. We did his autobiography as well, and he also has an extensive bit of history on Chicago and racism. I think, unless everyone's satisfied, didn't miss anybody. That's what I thought. Mr. Demi-4?
Yes, I just wanted to bring up one point. It seems as though, you know, we were led to believe that he was influenced by Mahatma Gandhi, but then it looks like he's leading his life like the Jesus. So it's this religious part of it is kind of confusing because it seems as though he knew that he was going to meet his demise and then was making reference to it like, you know, he would be martyred, so to speak. And then, so I guess if you look at it, he was just using the techniques that Gandhi had, but then was modeling his life after the character of Jesus, you know, in hindsight, we're not sure whether or not he existed or not. It's just a shame that someone would lose their life in that manner. I mute my line.
That was the one thing I wanted to get in. Eyes on the Prize has a great segment. I can just post the link, but they have a great segment on Dr. King's efforts in Chicago. And I mean, they have in color video. I have seen in color video of Dr. King before, but I'm so unaccustomed to seeing it that it's still like, whoa, got him in color. But they have like a lot of color images of what we heard in the footage. You can see him there with Mrs. King, with their children. You can see when they're throwing rocks and everything, when he gets hit, just tremendous footage. And when I looked at it and I thought, wow, that's so courageous. You know, you're going in here and I mean, woo. That's why I said this book, I feel like when you get to see what happened, this is when you can watch it. They got the footage. You can see exactly what happened. Man, when you see just an endless sea of raging racists, and I mean, they got white power signs, nigger go home, the children, wives, everybody is just outside everywhere. They're in the trees, and it just goes on for blocks. They're just coming out of the houses, everything. Niggers, kill him, nigger, get that nigger. Man. The courage to face that and say, oh, yeah, we're going to do it. No problem. Let's go. and with no weapon. We're just going to, you know, be peaceful, nonviolent. And yep, let's go. Wow. That does take some courage. I would have to at least acknowledge that. But I thought, wow, would I do this? And I said, I don't think so. And I said, not because I'm a coward, and I certainly am not trying to say I'm brave and I could do it. I'm just saying I don't understand the why. Because they acknowledge what they were trying to get, better housing for black people. That didn't happen as a result of this effort. Let's look at the result. That didn't happen. They failed in that. She said they did not, you know, stick up to their end of the bargain to have what they call fair housing for black people. If I don't think doing all of this, us going in here where we could potentially die at any moment, the police could just say, whoops, so we're tired of protecting these, you know, niggers. We got other things to do, whatever. You all get out the best way you can. We could die doing this for what? what's going to happen to solve any of our problems? And I don't see it. And I mean, they went back and did this over and over and over. They had marches where he was there. They had marches where he wasn't there. And I just didn't see a constructive result. I acknowledge the courage, but that sort of thing, like I just haven't seen where after we do all this, you know, there's going to be a business that we can start up. We're going to get, you know, a substantial amount of funding for something. All of us are going to have brand new houses in our name, paid in full. When we get to this, they'll put the deed in our, I mean, unless it's going to be something substantial, I'm not doing this just for the sake of us saying we did it and we got some attention. And it's something that we'll be able to tell our grandchildren if we live. We'll be able to tell our grandchildren. That just does not compute for me. But, you know, I could be simple-minded, as they say. With that, we will get to the second portion of the – folks slipped their hand in. The caller at 0747. Did you have commentary? 0747.
Greetings, Gus. I had a question about William Peppers. I heard an interview from him, and he claimed that he was the reason why Dr. King decided to go against the Vietnam War. And I was troubled by that, particularly after reading this book and understanding and being informed by Mrs. King's longstanding anti-war views and her influence. And I just wanted to comment upon that.
Grand. Yeah. William Pepper, shame on Gus for not make sure I mention William Pepper is also a suspected race soldier. He is a white person. We interviewed him on the program and got that in. So I am not surprised. That is a pretty common thing. If a black person does something, white people try to step in and take credit. Well, oh, I inspire. He was, you know, simple minded. Dr. King was never thinking of that until I said that. Does not surprise me. You know, at the end of the day, what does it mean to be white? He might have constructive information, as does Beryl Satter. I think I mentioned her earlier as well. I think they both have constructive information, but they are still members of the global white minority.
Gus?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I wanted to get one more comment in before we went to the second part. One of the things that I've been picking up as we're going through the reading, and even some of the photos that I saw, with Mrs. King and all of the outreach from the, I guess I'll call them the women movement groups that were reaching out to her before Dr. King's death. And as we talk about, and Neely Fuller talks about all the time, that, you know, white people do things years and years ahead. And I think about that in reference to how all this lines up, that, you know, Mrs. King really had and is gaining a platform and her own speaking and doing the things that she's doing. But when I looked at some of the photos that were in the book, and every time she went out in one of these movements with these white womenist groups, and she would be like one non-white female and maybe one other non-white female and probably 15 other white females. So it just kind of, as I'm looking at this progress, one of the things that I'm kind of looking at is how that whole movement is actually pushing what's going on today with the separation between non-white male, non-white female in our environment. But just something that the book has really been kind of helping me understand, and how it is probably utilizing, won't say using, but utilizing Mrs. King for that agenda. Just wanted to add that.
Interesting. We will leave it there. We'll get to the second audio segment. We'll have ample time afterwards for folks to continue the dialogue. So we're picking up right when Mrs. King is getting the word from Jesse Jackson that her husband has been shot. That's all she knows at this point. So we are still in chapter 15. This is Mrs. Coretta Scott King's autobiography, My Life, My Love, My Legacy, Context of White Supremacy, the second audio segment.
Again, I thought about how Martin had tried to prepare me for the inevitable. You know I probably won't live a long life. When I die, I don't want you to grieve for me. You go on and live a normal life. Still, I held out hope that Martin was alive and asked for details. Jesse tried to spare me. He was shot in the shoulder. Where is he? They've taken him to St. Joseph's Hospital, but maybe you should come to the Lorraine Motel, where we're staying, and we'll take you... No, maybe you should go to the hospital. No, why don't you just come here? I turned on the television. I saw Martin's face, and the commentator in the background talking about how my husband had been shot on the balcony at the Lorraine Motel. By that time, all of the kids except Bunny had run into my bedroom. I tried to turn the news off, but I was too late. Oh no, don't tell me, Yolanda cried and ran back out of the room. In a few seconds, Andy Young called. Have you heard about Martin? He asked. Jesse called me. Well, I tell you, it's pretty bad and you need to come right away. He's not dead yet, he added. He's still alive. The fact that Andy had to say that made me feel like this was going to be fatal. Martin wouldn't live. I had that strong sense. But I did what I always did in a crisis. I remained calm. I could have broken down and gone to pieces, but I didn't. I kept trying to think about how I had to hold up for my children. You need to bring somebody, Andy said to me. Juanita Abernathy, I've called her and she's coming. Yeah, bring her and someone else too. Bring Dora McDonald. Dora McDonald was Martin's secretary. She always seemed to have things under control, and everybody in the office admired her. She was always calm in her demeanor. You never saw her going to pieces. The phone kept ringing. Atlanta Mayor Ivan Allen called to say he was coming over and would provide me with a police escort to the airport. He came with his wife. Christine and Isaac, Martin's sister and brother-in-law, also came, and we all went to the airport together. As I was getting ready to leave, 7-year-old Dexter asked me, Mommy, when is Daddy coming home? I took a deep breath. Dexter, you know Daddy got shot in Memphis today, and I don't really know when he is coming home. When I get there, I'll let you know the answer. I kissed the children goodbye and headed to the airport. As soon as we got there, I heard a page over the public address system. It was for me. This is probably it, I thought then. The mayor said, let's get the page at the gate. In the meantime, I saw Dora McDonald coming, walking real fast, straight toward me. Mrs. King, let's find some place to sit down where I can talk to you. And in that moment, I knew Martin was dead. The only place we could find was the ladies' restroom, in the outer part near the counter. I saw Dora's pained expression. We embraced and held on to each other. I began weeping. Finally, the mayor just walked on in and said very formally, Mrs. King, I have the sad responsibility as the mayor of the city of Atlanta to inform you that your husband is dead. Would you like to go on to Memphis, or would you like to stay here for the night and go in the morning? I need to stay here and go back and see about the kids. I'll go in the morning. There was nothing I could do now. On the way home, I had an agonizing conversation with myself. What am I going to tell the kids? How would I tell them? I had to think about all the arrangements that had to be made. So much to be done. I've got to prepare myself. I've got to be strong, I thought. It was the Lenten season, leading up to Passion Week. Martin often made analogies in life to Good Friday and Easter. We go through our Gethsemanes as Christ did, but then Easter comes and there is a rebirth and a resurrection, he would say. So I thought about how this was a good time for him to go, to be identified with Christ and his suffering. Like Christ, Martin will be resurrected in the faith and actions of his people. His spirit will live on. Just thinking about the parallels in his life with that of Jesus gave me some consolation, which I sorely needed. I had to go deep within to find the inspiration to go home and face my children. When I returned home, my youngest child, 5-year-old Bunny, was asleep. Yolanda was sitting, calmly waiting for me in the foyer. Mommy, I'm not going to cry, she said. I'm not going to cry because my daddy's really not dead. His spirit will never die, and I will see him in heaven. Even as she insisted that she wasn't crying, tears were streaming down her soft little cheeks. "Mommy, should I hate the man who killed my daddy?" she asked. "No, darling. Your daddy wouldn't want you to do that." Marty seemed confused. He didn't want to talk at all. Earlier, Dexter had asked me, "When is Daddy coming home?" And trying to answer the question that was breaking my heart, I'd said, "Do you know your daddy was shot?" But Dexter had no concept of death or the finality of what had happened, and I wasn't ready to attempt to explain further, so I told him to go to sleep and promised that I would talk to him in the morning. That night, I received a call from Ralph. The authorities needed my permission to perform an autopsy. I was so tired and drained. I told him that I thought Martin would have wanted it, but said, "You make the decision, Ralph." Calls were pouring in, offering help and condolences. President Johnson called. He proclaimed Sunday, April 7th, a national day of mourning. Harry Belafonte called to say he would be at my side. But nothing anyone could have said or done would have eased the sorrow welling in my heart. I talked to Daddy King, who was understandably heartbroken. "I always felt I would go first," he said through his tears. A.D. had flown into Memphis to be with Martin on the day he died. Even as adults, they had kidded each other and wrestled much as they had as boys. In fact, hours before Martin died, he and A.D. were horsing around with each other, having a pillow fight. They even used to play tricks on Mama King by calling and disguising their voices, each one claiming to be the other. A.D. was terribly distraught. A year later, he too would be dead. But I believe he began dying the same day his brother died. The next morning, I rose early to get to Memphis and talk to the many callers expressing sympathy. Among them was Senator Bobby Kennedy, who offered a private plane to bring back Martin's body. I accepted the offer gratefully as a gesture of friendship, though Ralph and Andy questioned my decision because of the political implication of Bobby being a political candidate. Senator Kennedy also arranged to put in 3 more phone lines in our home to handle the continuous flow of callers. On Friday morning, I flew to Memphis. Martin's sister, Christine, her husband, Isaac, and Jean Young, Juanita Abernathy, Fred Bennett, Dora McDonald, and Bill Rutherford of SCLC waited with me inside the plane while Martin's body was brought aboard. When I saw the casket being lowered, the moment froze in my mind. My beloved Martin, the love of my life, was gone from me. The finality of that was overwhelming. We landed back in Atlanta, where hundreds of people had gathered at the airport. Ralph, Andy, and Bernard Lee flew back to Atlanta with us. The children were brought to meet us and boarded the plane. Andy took Bunny in his arms. I remembered then that I'd left without preparing them to see their father in a casket. I hadn't really talked to any of them except Yoki, or done enough to help them understand that their father was dead. But how do you explain such things to a 5-year-old? I took Bunny from Andy and held her in my arms. She was innocently bouncing around. "Mommy, Mommy, where is my daddy?" she asked. I didn't say anything. Couldn't find the words. "Mommy, where is my daddy?" she repeated. I thought, my God, how can I tell her? I don't know what to say. Finally, I spoke. "Bunny, you know your daddy is asleep in the back of the plane, and he's lying there in his casket. When you see him, he won't be able to speak to you. His spirit has gone to live with God." "Is he hungry?" she asked, before becoming very quiet. As a family, we stood in the doorway of the plane. Somebody wanted to photograph us standing together. I have looked at that picture many times over the years. It is such a perfect image. Everyone has the right expression, the one that reflects his or her feelings at that moment. We have forlorn looks on our faces. Every last one of us. We left the airport and went on to Hanley's funeral home. I was concerned about what Martin would look like, as the bullet had severely shattered his jaw. The undertakers had patched his face, however, and it looked pretty good. When the kids saw their father's body at the funeral home, I thought it would help them understand. Bunny still didn't say anything when she saw him, nor did she ask any questions. I wanted to explain death to her, not its finality, but its continuation of life through the spirit. That's a difficult concept to explain to children, though. In retrospect, I regret that I didn't better prepare Bernice and Dexter, my younger children, but I did the best I could. The family decided to have Martin lie in state in Sister's Chapel at Spelman College from Saturday afternoon until Monday afternoon. Then he was carried to Ebenezer Baptist Church to stay until the funeral on Tuesday. Many thousands of people of all classes and colors waited for hours to pay their last respects to my husband. When I went with the children to Ebenezer on Monday, lines of people stretched around the block. For so long, Martin had been in the heart and soul of the masses. Now they wanted their time with him. I kept saying to myself, oh, I wish he knew how much people loved him. I remembered the times he had been depressed and needed a lift. If only he could have seen how much his sacrifices meant to people. The news of Martin's death was televised to the world. His murder reverberated through the national psyche like the assassination of JFK or Abraham Lincoln, or the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Virtually everyone could remember what he or she was doing when they heard the terrible news. People expressed their grief in many different ways. They cried. They gathered in churches across America and told their stories about meeting Martin, about working with him. There were prayers for us, his family. And some rioted. The impact of my husband's assassination was felt deeply by millions around the world, but it resonated especially in black neighborhoods. Some people took their grief to the streets. Riots hit more than 100 cities across the nation. Washington, D.C. was hit the hardest. The violence, the fires, and the shootings were such ironic tributes to a prophet of nonviolence. Yet I understood the language of despair, even though I could not condone it. Atlanta, where we lived, was one of the few cities that did not go up in flames, and I believe that was because many of us, white and black leaders alike, went on the offensive. That Saturday, I made a statement saying that nothing could hurt Martin more than for those he left behind to solve their problems with violence. He gave his life in search of a more excellent way, I said, a more effective way, a creative rather than a destructive way. He never hated. He never despaired of well-doing, and he encouraged us to do likewise. That was my first press conference without Martin. It gave me a strange, empty feeling. On Monday, I took another out-of-character step. With coaching from Harry Belafonte, I decided to continue with the march in Memphis. Harry had told me, "People across the nation are so down. If you could find the strength to go to Memphis, if people could see your strength and determination, it would lift their spirits." Immediately, I thought, this is what Martin would want me to do. It felt right. I would finish what Martin and the movement had started. As I thought about the perpetrators of this evil act, I said to myself, they only killed his physical body. They can't kill his spirit. For 14 years, I had been with Martin in the thicket of controversy. My husband and I had been emotional twins. He thought of me as so close I was only a heartbeat away. I was his confidant. He was my best friend. I was his best student. He was the icing on my cake, the cream in my coffee. We could finish each other's sentences, feel each other's wounds, and share each other's jokes. Now I had to stand in for him, representing us both without him. That Monday, I flew to Memphis on a private plane provided by Harry. Along with Harry, I took Yoki, Marty, and Dexter, as well as Justine Smadbeck, the days, needed to hear others saying such good things about their father. A speech had been prepared for me, too, but when I looked at it, it seemed so flat that I spoke without notes, from the heart. I challenged the crowds to see that Martin's spirit never dies, and that we will go forward from this experience, which to me represents the crucifixion, on toward the resurrection and the redemption of the spirit. I ended with a question. How many must die before we can really have a free and true and peaceful society? If we can catch the spirit and the true meaning of this experience, I believe this nation can be transformed into a society of love, justice, and brotherhood, where all men can really be brothers. I learned later that when I stepped forward that day, some news reports said I was making my debut as a leader. That was not my objective. I had a commitment even larger than Martin's. I wanted to be useful and available to God, and I was praying to God for direction, a way to perfect my life after Martin, and to continue our work and follow the calling we had both cherished. I was separated from Martin now, but never from the movement, never from the cause. As the day of Martin's homegoing grew closer, time seemed to stand still and hover over me like a heavy cloud. The preparation, however, made the process easier to bear. As long as I kept myself busy, I didn't have time to cry. The planning was therapy. In planning the homegoing, I kept foremost in my mind what Martin would have wanted. I also wanted to ensure that people who came would have some opportunity to be part of a service. Eventually, we had to create two services. One was an outdoor memorial at Morehouse College, where Martin was an undergraduate, and where Dr. Benjamin Mays, who was Martin's mentor, had been president. The family also wanted to have a march. This would be Martin's last march. But how would we transport Martin's body? We felt that he should have something fancy, like the kind of caisson that carries the bodies of presidents. Yet we also wanted something simple. What about the mule train that Martin talked about taking to Washington during the Poor People's Campaign, A.D. suggested. Gosh, that's a great idea, I thought. Martin would like that. This meant finding the mule and the wagon. Hosea Williams was very good at handling creative situations of this kind. He searched around and actually found a wagon outside an antique store. But this was the day before the funeral, and the store was closed. They couldn't ask the owner for it, so they borrowed it. Of course, they took it back. Next, Hosea and the others found some mules on a farm outside Atlanta. I was elated about the mule and wagon carrying Martin because he'd been so excited by the idea of taking mule trains from Mississippi through Jackson, on through Alabama and Georgia, and into Washington. The mule, which was used in farming, symbolized poverty and the desperate plight of the poor in this country. There was much debate about the eulogy. Christine, Edith, and Martin's secretary, Dora McDonald, had joined me at our home to discuss it. We fought back tears and an overwhelming feeling of grief as we tried to decide who would preach it. Christine told me that no one could do it better than Martin himself had months before at Ebenezer. "Every now and then I think about my own death," he had told the congregation. "Tell them not to talk too long," he said, but added his hope that they would say that Martin Luther King tried to give his life to serving others. "Yes, if you want to say that I was a drum major, say that I was a drum major for justice. Say that I was a drum major for peace. I was a drum major for righteousness. And all the other shallow things will not matter." I had a copy of the recording which I had listened to with my sister only a few months before. I listened to it again at 2 a.m. before the homegoing service. The rightness of using it fell upon me. Early on the morning of the funeral, I greeted a steady stream of mourners, from Hollywood celebrities to neighborhood residents at our home. At one point, I looked up and saw that someone had escorted Jacqueline Kennedy back to my bedroom, where I was receiving a few guests. I had felt deeply for her when her husband was assassinated only 5 years earlier. Her visit inspired me. I had always admired the grace and dignity she exemplified in the aftermath of President Kennedy's death. Her strength and courage helped lift and hold a nation together. I will never forget that on the day of JFK's funeral, she invited a group of children upstairs at the White House to celebrate John John's birthday with a party. That was her way of trying to create a normal life for her children. Likewise, I didn't want my children to get caught up in the tragedy of their father's death or the aftermath of the riots that followed. I wanted them to go on living as normally as possible. The way Jackie conducted herself helped me understand that I could get through this too. I saw her as a model of what could be done. Oh, how nice of me, and said, in reference to the address I made after the march I had led in Memphis, "You speak so well." I thanked her. At the funeral, my children each handled their grief differently. Yoki told me, "I was thinking about myself, and I don't know what I would do if I were in your shoes." My goodness, how mature she is for her 12 years, I thought. She's lost her father, but she's empathizing with me as the mother and the widow, because she knows I've had to take care of everything in the family. She showed so much grace, and I was so proud of her. She cried a little at the funeral, but she never broke down and cried for days like some kids can. In fact, none of the children did. I believe Marty was confused. He did not say much. It was like he didn't know what to say. Dexter tried to express himself. "My daddy has gone to the heaven in the sky, but his spirit is alive," he told me. But I could tell he was just repeating what he'd been told. The boys were too young to make sense of murder, death, and eternity. Little Bunny sat next to me during the homegoing service. It was April and very warm. At one point, she lay in my lap. We were captured in a Pulitzer Prize-winning photograph by Moneta Sleet, Jr. for Ebony Magazine. Another photograph from the funeral, captured by photographer Flip Schulke, appeared on the cover of Life magazine. The expression on my face in that photograph, which a reporter called the Mona Lisa smile, aptly captured my great sense of fulfillment. In the end, the service was so beautiful. When it came time for Martin's taped voice to be played for his eulogy, the sound of her father's voice confused Bunny. I believe she thought he was speaking from his casket. Over the years, she had to struggle with the fear of funerals and of death, of people coming back to life. Lots of children make these types of associations as they personalize death. With time and after other experiences with death, she became able to manage those feelings, although she has never fully overcome them. When we came out of the church and into the sunlight, we saw tens of thousands of people standing in the streets, having listened to the service over loudspeakers. Together, we began our march from Ebenezer to Morehouse College for the memorial service. We marched because Martin had spent so much of his life marching for justice and freedom. We were awed and deeply grateful that more than 150,000 people marched with him. It was the most meaningful, inspiring march Martin ever led. I couldn't march all the way from Ebenezer to Morehouse with the funeral procession, however. The effects of my fibroid tumor surgery lingered, and I didn't want to overexert myself. I marched part of the way to Morehouse with the kids, and rode the rest of the way. We were almost at the college when Bunny asked me, "Mommy, how is Daddy going to eat?" I struggled with what to say. I thought about saying something like, "Well, he'll eat angel food cake," but I couldn't. I didn't say anything, hoping that she would soon forget it and wouldn't keep asking me questions. Finally, we made it to Morehouse. It was a long, hard way, the rush and press of so many people, the slow clop-clop of the mules. As our procession passed, the huge crowds fell silent. Some knelt in prayer. After the prayers and scripture readings, Mahalia Jackson sang "Precious Lord, Take My Hand," which Martin had asked tenor saxophonist Ben Branch to play for him at a rally that would have taken place only hours after his assassination. Dr. Benjamin E. Mays spoke. Then it was time for the interment. A.D. had been escorting me throughout the day. As we reached the gravesite, he turned to me and said, "Coretta, I can't go any further with you." I understood. The gravesite was the hardest part. It's such a separation. "Okay," I said, but I knew I had to have someone with me. So I turned to Harry, who was by my side. "I would like you and my daddy to surround me as we go to the cemetery." I had a terrible feeling about leaving Martin there. When we were readying ourselves to go home, Bunny asked, "What's a spirit?" Helplessly, I asked my sister Edith, "How do you explain spirit to a 5-year-old?" Then I said, "Bunny, you know people loved your daddy, and he loved them. He loved everybody. They have killed the dreamer," I thought, "but they will never kill his dream. I vowed that I would carry that dream forward. I prayed that my children and all our supporters could see that my Martin spirit, strong and determined, would carry forth, and his work would live on."
16. With a prayer in my heart, I could greet the morning. Martin is gone. He's just gone. How many times I must have repeated that to myself, over and over and over. It was like the saying of it could somehow confirm this surreal new reality. There were times when I would open my eyes with the joyous expectation of Martin being there. Then it would hit me like a cold chill. He was not there, and he was never going to be there again. Never. I had to let him go. There is nothing like finality, the presence of an absolute absence. I never cried in public because I did not want to project an image of weakness or negativity. I wanted the public to know that the King family had the strength to love, to forgive, and to go on despite this great tragedy that had beset us. But when I was alone, the tears would roll down my cheeks in torrents. In our bedroom, the scent of his Old Spice cologne lingered in the lining of his best black pinstripe suit in the closet. In the bathroom, his toothbrush faced mine. There was the imprint on the sheets where he had lain, his shoes, some muddy and scuffed from marches, neatly lined up on racks, would come in the morning. But I assure you, morning does not return without a long passage through the lonely nights of heartache. Sometimes I felt that my joy would never return. For months, I tried to console myself with the knowledge that Martin was in a better place and was happy. I knew I was crying for myself, feeling sorry for myself. Martin wouldn't want me to weep over him. I was no longer a wife, but I was still a parent, and a single parent at that. This was the motivating thought that kept me going. No matter what else I did, I had to be a mother first. I had to say to myself, "You are a mother first." It took that kind of self-talk to get me out of bed in the morning. Sometimes I just wanted to stay there under the covers. But I could not break down. I did not want my children to see me out of control, because then they might lose their way. So I had my cry before I came out of my room, and then I opened the door with a forceful determination I had never known before. I did not just open it. I thrust it open. But it required determination that came from beyond myself. When I came out of my bedroom, I had to leave my feelings, my heartaches, and my anxieties behind. It almost felt like getting into character for one of my operatic performances. I had to step out of the fog of painful reality into a zone where I could perform as a mother and comfort others. Sometimes I paused at the door, my hand on the knob, making sure I had my emotions in check. And then, with a prayer in my heart and a smile on my face, I could greet the morning. While my first love was my children, I also understood I had to spread myself across a great span, keeping my husband's mission alive and institutionalizing his legacy. I had to keep it present, relevant. I had to continue my own mission, working for world peace abroad and nonviolence here at home. In death, as in life, we have to go on. For my children, the way was not easy. They each had to wrestle with and endure major problems. The loss of their father to an assassin's bullet was catastrophic. The riots and the looting that followed were so at odds with our principles of nonviolence that they were deeply confused. All of them had questions. They could not understand why their father, the prophet of nonviolence, had met with such a violent end. They wondered if that same fate would take me from them. For a time after the assassination, Bunny would pore through family photo albums and ask me who would be the next to die. Fears about death plagued her. I think my two oldest children, Yoki and Marty, handled the passing of their father a little better than Bunny because they had such strong, wonderful memories of Martin. Because she was only 5 years old when he was taken from her, Bunny was more deeply scarred and confused. I worried about what was going on deep down inside her because she was always the quietest of my children. After school, all the children would report on what they'd learned. But when it was Bunny's turn, she often said, "I don't have anything to share." How do you get children to love and trust others when they have been confronted with such a devastating loss? One thing that was very important to me as a parent was always to set a good example in front of my children. You cannot tell children to act one way and behave differently yourself. I've always tried to conduct myself in an honest and moral way, a commitment I made long before marrying Martin. As a Scot, I had high moral standards instilled in me at a young age, and basic concepts of honesty, love of neighbor, and helping others were ethics I tried to teach my children by the way I carried myself, the way I loved others, no matter how they treated me, and the issues I championed. There were causes that I championed and others that Martin gave priority, but after his death, our causes, our callings, became one. In the months immediately following Martin's death, thousands of requests poured in from all over the world asking me to speak on behalf of Martin, accept awards in his name, and discuss issues that were important to me. Of course, I could not accept them all. I often felt overwhelmed, pulled in too many directions. I engaged in constant prayer, calling upon God to guide me on the right path. I was in perpetual motion, trying to accept the many awards and recognitions. In January 1969, my friend and special assistant, Bernita Bennett, and I left for a trip to India. Before arriving in the country, we stopped over in Verona, Italy, where the government bestowed upon me the San Valentino Universal Love Award. I was the first Black person and first non-Italian to receive this honor. We also stopped in Rome, where I had an audience with Pope Paul VI at Vatican City. In New Delhi, I accepted the Jawaharlal Nehru Award, which was posthumously given to Martin in a ceremony at New Delhi University. While in India, I addressed university groups, rallies, and a group of so-called untouchables, thus building on the relationships Martin and I had established when we visited India in 1959. In March 1969, Bernita, along with my sister Edith and sister-in-law Christine, traveled to London, where I became the first woman to preach a statutory service at St. Paul's Cathedral. Standing there in my academic gown and hat, upon the spot where Martin had preached en route to his acceptance of the Nobel Peace Prize in 1964, I found myself deeply moved. The British Martin Luther King Jr. Foundation had invited me to London, and the insight I gained there into the ways other nations were institutionalizing my husband's vision inspired me. During that time abroad, I could feel myself making progress in my inner healing. I talked not of sorrow, but of the privilege of being able to follow that which was meaningful and fulfilling to me. I urge the British to address their own racial issues through the power of nonviolence. I also had the opportunity to speak and share my concerns with Mrs. Harold Wilson, wife of British Prime Minister Harold Wilson, at No. 10 Downing Street. And before leaving Europe, I rekindled my singing career performing freedom concerts in England, Germany, and Holland. This rush of international invitations shortly after Martin's death was a humbling reminder that our mission was respected on a global stage. I had long understood civil and human rights to be a global challenge. How could I look at the downtrodden, the untouchables in India, for example, and not connect them to the same forces that had attempted to develop a caste system at home? The principles of nonviolence and the creation of a beloved community in which every individual would be respected and treated with dignity resonated in every corner of the globe. But while I welcomed the opportunity to share our message, I could not keep my suitcase packed and continue this sort of global trek forever. I had to settle down and focus to find a place at which I could make the greatest difference to the human condition. I had an idea of what I had to do as an institution builder, but with so much coming at me simultaneously, I had to reflect seriously on what course I would take as an activist working to shape public policy. At times I felt my road ahead would be a lonely one. Martin had always had me, but now I had to go on without him. These feelings of loneliness, however, didn't last long. All around me I had a strong nexus of family and friends, including Edith and her son Arturo, who came to live with me for 2 years after Martin's death. Edith even took a leave of absence from work. Christine, a professor at Spelman College, her husband Isaac, and Martin's brother A.D. and his wife Naomi were also staunch sources of support. Of course, I had my own mother and father, and Daddy and Mama King, all powerhouses of love. And there were my friends, like Cecil and Francis Thomas from my Lincoln Normal days, and Fran Lucas from my Antioch days, and Robert and Letty Green, friends since early 1960s. Harry Belafonte had continuously been a financial help as well as an advisor, and Andrew Young had pitched in as a surrogate father. So I never had to walk alone, despite those nagging feelings in the early years that this would be my path.
And that will do it for the second audio segment. Folks have commentary they would like to share. The number to dial is 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. If other folks have commentary they would like to share, feel free. All the folks who dialed in who have a hand up should be with us. We'll start off. I don't think we heard from Emmy first time around. If you have commentary, you should be with us.
Can I be heard?
Yes,
am
ma'am.
I clear?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Greetings, everybody. Number one, I am so happy Miss Felicia Rashad is on the audiobook now. I love the sound of her voice, and I love how she's narrating it already. And I think that if that was done intentionally, like if there wasn't anything that was wrong with that first narrator that made it so that she couldn't finish the book, that I also think that that's very artistic and creative to actually have two different people narrate to kind of mark the differences between Miss King before Dr. King died and then have Miss Rashad's voice be Miss King after she died. So if that's intentional for that reason, I think that that's wonderful. last week, Gus, you asked the question of the women, how do they feel? And I wanted to give it some considerable thought about how I felt about that the wives were not permitted to speak during the Million Man March.
March on Washington.
And on one hand, oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. Excuse me. On one hand, I want to feel some type of way, but on another hand, within the context of white supremacy, I don't. I don't think that we have a proper model for what leadership would look like, what relationships look like, couples look like. I don't. Revolution looks like. I don't think that we really know. So what we're doing and how we're behaving, we're mimicking white people. And I think white people have this issue amongst them where it's like the men want to suppress the women. But I don't think in antiquity we had that. I've done some looking into it, and we don't necessarily have that same kind of thing. We do now, but then again, around the world, non-white people have been living in the psyche of white people, so that's how I look at it. So I think it's something that a conversation we want to make sure that we have, that, you know, Black men are not trying to just be white men. Like, we just need to do away with the whole be like white people altogether. So it's unfortunate, yes, that then we're not allowed to speak. And I think only one wife was able to wave or say hi or something like that. But I don't think that that's the focus, and I'm not going to make that a big deal. And I think that now Black men who consider themselves leaders and looking at that and hearing that, I think if when they're being honest and introspective enough, would make different choices, because then that gives credence and fuel to the fire that now Black women need to go align themselves with white women. And there's a difference too, you know, Black men are not controlling Black women's access to things in the way that white people are controlling Black people or non-white people's access to things. So they're different levels. I'm not trying to take away from how anybody feels oppressed by another people or whatever, if that's the case. I just don't think that it's the same. I think our biggest problem is white supremacy, not patriarchy. Although I've had many conversations like that, but that's how I feel. Like, it's unfortunate, but yeah, move it on. When it comes to the model, some of the things, I think that's true for Ms. King. I was a little frustrated, and I don't know why. It could have just been that I wasn't really feeling the first narrator's voice or something. It was just too, like, overly romantic or something. And but this whole notion of how do you explain these things to children, it kind of frustrates me, because I am placing these people in a very high regard in terms of their intelligence, and I'm not sure how you don't explain these things to children. I thought that was the whole purpose of Christianity and religion anyway, was to give some type of explanation for the afterlife, which means that concept of, if we're talking about the Holy Spirit, I think, like, what do you mean you don't know how, what are they learning in Sunday school, if not what spirits are and all that kind of thing? But I do sympathize and empathize with her struggle to explain that their father is dead. But some of these things about where'd he go, what's he eating, if he comes back, like, I think that sometimes we do what white people do. White people lie to their kids all the time about stuff. And I don't really, they have that luxury that they can just do that because they're running the world. We don't really have that luxury, so I'm not so sure why we continue to do that, other than we don't have a model for how to raise our children. I don't think any child at five should be walking around confused about white people and racism and how come we can't do these things or go here and stuff. Explain it. White people, this is the whole reason I'm doing everything that I'm doing. Daddy's never home because white people are, you know. So that was a little frustrating to me. As a female, I am not a mother. I am not a wife. So let me put that out there. There's no criticism, BGQ. It's just frustrating because I feel like white people, I know that white people have conversations with their kids about us, and yet we just are not having those things, even in a time when it was, like, all over the place, and we really needed to. I cried, I'm not going to lie, I was being such a girl, because the one thing that I do really appreciate, outside of being able to learn new things that I did not learn before, man, I know that she loved Dr. King, and that feeling is, I've been in love, but not the same way. I'm not married. Like I said, I don't have kids and stuff like that. But so when you devote your life and you're each other's breath, just that whole thing, I sympathize. I wonder if she ever really, truly, truly recovered. And, but I could see her being in a state of shock and not really knowing what to do or how to be. And so, I felt that part of the book. And then the other last thing that I want to say, listening to the book, chess. White people are, I mean, sometimes when I hear certain things, I have reactions to it like, whoa, that's crazy that white people did that. But what I think is even more crazy is that white people, how skillful everything is. Like, hearing the story, it puts everything, I'm like, wait a minute, that seems so calculated. Like, they're so, yes, planning hundreds of years in advance, knowing. And white people are master psychologists. And that's one thing I really hope that I'm working on, but that we work on, you know, overall, is understanding that white people are not looking at individual black people. White people are generalizing, and they understand how psychology works, how groupthink works, how a leader works, how taking out a leader works, how, you know, we'll use and just show just everything. It's so, wow. I'm just in awe sometimes. I'm overwhelmed at it wasn't even just these things that are horrific that happen individually. It's collective, like, on. And I think I'm beginning to see that collective global energy effort in maintaining the system of white supremacy, even with the Nobel Peace Prize. I'm sure they sat down and figured, okay, we'll give him the prize now. He'll go ahead and do this. Oh, wait a minute. He started to talk about Vietnam too soon. Go ahead, let's take him out, put him in the rain, let's keep it moving. Everyone will mourn, we'll get the wife. I mean, all of these things. And I just sit there like, oh my goodness, we really, I don't even know if we're playing checkers. Like, the level of this chess, I don't even know if it's like white people playing each other chess and we're just on the board. I don't even think we're like on the black side where we're making moves. We're just pawns. Like, it's amazing because that's just how well it's being conducted. These white people are something else. And so that's something that I'm definitely taking away from the book. So if there's time later, I'll chime in. I thank you for listening.
Indeed, indeed. If we have other folks who have commentary they would like to share, lines should be open. Feel free to participate.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. So I'm just going to start out. You speak so well. I kind of stood on that for a little while. You speak so well. And I think we hear about that so often today. And just kind of going back just to what Emmy said, I mean, this was a very emotional chapter. Definitely have to take my hat off. Sorry for that metaphor. Definitely have to give Mrs. King a lot of black self-respect. And just as an attempted parent myself, the amount of children that she had to kind of deal with during this tragedy, just a lot. The thing that kind of shifted my emotion a little bit is I'll call it white idolizing. Just that meeting that she had with, as she called her, Jackie. This kind of friend, this friend that she just automatically built this relationship with her, automatically never met her before. I guess maybe that time during the service in the past. But it just summed it up for me, even when they just met, that she said that she was going to give her a hug. And it's like Jackie gave her like this, you know, that stiff arm that you get, like when somebody's not inviting you into that space. And I think to me, that would have been kind of like my, wow, like this person is definitely not in the same place that I'm in. And let me readjust myself. But I think that there was that white idolizing that was going on so much that she didn't even sense it. But that you speak so well, even that, it just kind of throws me a little bit. This kind of goes back to Mrs. King when her family, her uncle had passed away.
And at least how it was related to in the book, that there wasn't that type of sentiment that I felt when President Kennedy had gotten shot. It just kind of seemed like every time there was a white person, any Kennedy member that had gotten shot, it was a shock. It was an utter, even though she hadn't met these people, probably only talked to them on the phone, and even though these individuals with talking to her and helping her out in one instance was the same people that were signing paperwork to have her phones bugged and wiretaps going on in her home, and even after the funeral where they invited to put three more phone lines. I mean, this is the same group that actually had your one line bugged, and now you're going to allow them to put three more lines in the home. And I guess maybe during that time there's a lot of trauma going on, and somebody else should have been there, but just that automatic trust, I think for me is kind of what we still see today. Kind of go back. I also wanted to kind of touch on the fact that there was a point, I'm going to go back to it in the reading real quick here. So there was a part when President Kennedy had gotten shot, and this is on page 117, and it says Yoki, who was 8 at the time, had heard the news at school. She came running in the door and into my arms. "Mommy," she sobbed, "they killed the president, and he didn't do a single thing to anybody. We'll never get our freedom now." And then when she spoke about Yoki and how Yoki felt in reference to her dad being killed, she had mentioned that at the funeral, each handled the grief differently. "Yoki told me, I was thinking about myself, and I don't know what I would do if I were in your shoes. My goodness, how mature she is for 12 years old. I thought she lost her father, but she's empathizing with me as a mother and the widow, because she knows I've had to take care of everything in the family. She showed me how much grace, and I was proud of her. She cried a little at the funeral, but she never broke down and cried for days like some kids can. In fact, none of the children did." So for me, again, just kind of connecting those two experiences, and I kind of saw the same thing. It changed a little bit as they spoke about Mrs. King weeping in the later pages, but that was a little difficult for me. As I looked at page 174, I had a little hope because it spoke about Bunny, and it seemed like Bunny was the least confused out of everyone. So, you know, Bunny came around, and as they mentioned, she was 5 years old, and she wasn't talkative, and she was saying the things that, you know, she wasn't trusting of people. And I think that's kind of, you know, after being abused for years, and she's 5, and here, you know, Miss King has been seeing her uncle, seeing her father, all these things, and here Bunny is at 5 years old, actually coming out, and she's like, "No, I'm not happy. I don't feel this." And I think, like I said, she probably was the least confused out of everyone in the family. But I just wanted to touch on it.
Right, yeah. On. Just to make sure we get everybody in. Other folks, appreciate the commentary. Did other folks that dialed in have commentary they wanted to share?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Another great section. I agree with love Ms. Rashad's voice. A lot of black self-respect there. Really appreciate the detail in Ms. King describing things specifically for victims of racism who have ever lost somebody that they really care about. Her describing the scent and the cologne that really stuck with me. You know, it's just one of those things, just the details. Quick comment. Maybe somebody else could answer this question for me. Like, Harry Belafonte sounded like he was really helping out financially a lot. Obviously, I'm a little younger, so I'm not familiar with that period of time, but maybe somebody could give a modern day equivalent on the entertainer side. Like, what's he the equivalent to? Was he like a Sammy Davis Jr. that was really big back then? Or because it sounded like he really just gave a whole lot of financial assistance to that family. And I'm just curious, you know, during that time frame, how big a star was he? And was he really, really well known? The amount of support that she had from different people, that was very, very helpful. I think a lot of times when you're dealing with death, specifically in the system of white supremacy, things can be overwhelming, but I'm glad that her and her family were able to support her. I think I said last week, I just still find it really tacky that immediately after her husband has died, she's just being traveled around the world and being honored and given all these different awards. And I've got to know that, you know, in the back of her mind, I'm just thinking, she knows racism did this to my husband. And I also find it very interesting that in that last segment, I think Gus mentioned this, it was last week or the week before, how little the word racism is even being used. I don't think I heard it one time in that last segment in talking about his death, you know, injustice and bigotry, but racism really didn't have anything to do with Mr. King's death. And it's a great book, and I mean my line. Thanks, Gus.
Yes, sir. Harry Belafonte was an enormous entertainer at that time. Sammy Davis Jr., he was younger than Sammy Davis Jr., lighter complexion. He was an award-winning singer. He had award-winning albums, and he was a movie star. So I was trying to think of somebody modern to compare him to, but you don't even have a whole lot of folks who are like award-winning, not just I did a movie and, you know, I made a couple albums or what have you, but award-winning albums and then respected for the films that he did as well. So yes, he was very, very successful. Probably one of the most prominently known entertainers, certainly black entertainers, but I'd say entertainers period in the world at that time. He was beloved all over the planet. Other folks who are with us who had commentary that we haven't heard from the second time around, feel free. Anybody else have a hand up that had commentary? Second audio segment? Retired firefighter?
Yes, sir. I was saying, can I be heard? I didn't know you muted me. but anyway, yes, I would say at that particular time, probably the only actor that was equivalent to Harry Belafonte was his friend, Sidney Poitier. And they actually worked together a lot. In the 70s, they had several movies together. And as Gus mentioned, he also was a very good music performer at the time. And he had pretty good, he gave pretty good support to Mrs. King and the children. First thing I have down here is notes, the trauma of losing a father who was idolized and loathed by a lot of people, by millions of people, made a permanent effect on Dr. King's children. I don't know if it would be talked about later on in the book, but certainly in my research through a course of time, you could almost sense the permanent damage that was done to them when their especially when the father was murdered. There's no doubt in my mind that his death and funeral was the most publicized event for a black person ever, unless somebody can tell me something different. I can recall even as a 10th grade, that means I'm not 10th grade, but 5th grade, I probably was like 11 years old, that it was on TV almost, it was definitely on TV the whole day. We're talking about the 1960s. And during that time, probably the only black people, black males that was on TV that wasn't cutting the fool in some kind of way was Harry Belafonte and especially Sidney Poitier with movies and whatnot. And they basically ran the whole funeral in entirety. I remember that. Firefighters, and I got in parentheses, administrators, you know, like chiefs or whatnot, people make decisions, played a part in Dr. King's assassination. Dr. King and his entourage was being spied on, and the headquarters was the headquarters of that spying of the of his entourage was that a fire station that was in running distance of the Lorraine Hotel, because that's what they did when they heard the shots. A lot of people that was in the fire station ran towards the Lorraine Hotel. I have down here a lot of, based on the prior reading, just wanted to say, if anybody didn't know, a lot of black people in Chicago, black Chicagoans, migrated from Mississippi. So basically, they left from an environment to see similarities in another environment that they experienced. I've learned that because I went to college with a lot of my college teammates were from Chicago. Bobby Kennedy squeezed the most political attention from Dr. King's death. He made this famous announcement, I believe in Indianapolis, and got a lot of political clout from it. Also, as we heard, he supplied an airplane. And mind you, at that time, he was vying for the president of the United States at the time. And now, mind you now, all the while, when he was attorney general, he was willfully spying on Dr. King and his family and the members of the SCLC at the time. So, you know, that's the Kennedys. They were experts at what they do. Moving on, the power of that rifle was actually designed to kill large animals, the one that killed Dr. King, to whereas when that 30-aught round tore through his jaw neck area, it was reported that it severed his spinal cord. And had he lived, he'd probably been a paraplegic, from my understanding. Imagine the millions of black children who have similar experiences with their fathers. And the reason why I put that down is because I deal with a lot of people, children, and it kind of like helps me out. Based on, you know, knowing them and you know, basically how you communicate with another person, especially if they've had that kind of trauma in their life.
Hang on one second. I just want to make sure we nab everybody before we run out of time. Retired firefighter, my apologies.
Yes, sir.
Anybody that we have not heard from the second audio segment have commentary they want to share?
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I don't have much to say, but I have to say that according to the book, Mrs. King's reaction when she found that her husband had been murdered was not a normal reaction. And we can, you know, blame that on the system of white supremacy because of the retardation of our social process. But just the sheer fact that, like the firefighter said, I can remember I was a little older than he was. I think I was about 13. But I can remember the fear that I felt. and it was, I guess, when young Yolanda made the statement about Kennedy, you know, it just didn't seem to reflect the fear that would be there after your father is killed and your husband. And I know it's a lot of mixed emotions there, but it just seems to be, I don't know, it doesn't seem normal to me. And like one caller said, it seems the five-year-old had more of a normal type reaction than most of the others. And there's been some controversy about the moment that Dr. King was killed. There's photographs showing different people pointing. You know, and that's another thing. If somebody's hit with a high-powered sniper rifle, you know, remaining out in the open like that when you don't know if there's going to be more rounds, it just brought some skepticism concerning that. And I will say that a lot of respect for Harry Belafonte, and he was a major, major force in entertainment as well as social activism. And I believe that's all I got to say. Thanks for taking the call.
Yes, sir, Mr. Demery Ford. We have anybody else that had commentary second time around? We get everybody? Spectacular. A couple quick notes I'll get in on the second session. The word tributes was used when they labeled these as riots, the disturbances after King's assassination. I don't think they were tributes. I think they were a lot of victims of racism who were angry. I don't think they were doing that to say, oh, we love Dr. King. I think they were saying we are upset with black people being killed and brutalized and terrorized under the system of white supremacy. That was curious, calling those tributes. When on the next page over, it says Atlanta, where we lived, was one of the few cities that did not go up in flames. And I believe that was because many of us, white and black leaders alike, I felt that was another moment, the emphasis on, hey, white people are hanging out with us, type sentiment I've talked about before. And again, all of black people's leaders are white. Let's see. If people, the strength on the next page where she mentions Harry Belafonte helping, giving her some coaching to get her through to do the march, and the strength to do this, just that word I'm cautious about. I think frequently black people, I know we talked about this when we read medical apartheid last year, and just talking about the damage that racism, white supremacy has done to our health. But I'm cautious of black people being thought of or feeling that we have to, you know, live up to some ideal of strength. It's great to want to be powerful and to want to do things, but I mean, in a state of total trauma and victimization, it seems like consistently black people are the ones that are supposed to be, I'm strong, I can take it. And strong generally for us, it ends up being in some sort of context of how much punishment and abuse I can take. And I feel like that's really, really, really dangerous for black people. Let's see. From chapter 16. Yes, the impact on children. I think that's what I had said at the very beginning. This entire book just seems to be a big catalog of trauma, starting from the very beginning with her house being burned down when she was a child, her father's sawmill being burned down, relatives being lynched, the house being bombed when they start the Birmingham campaign. I mean, it's just endless, endless trauma. Every day people calling and talking about they're going to kill you and your family and nigga this and nigga that. Just endless, endless trauma. Generational trauma. And again, with the children, where she has this passage for a time after the assassination, Bunny would pour through family photo albums and ask me who would be the next to die. That is victim of racism, white supremacy, and the impact of mental health. And I think also, I don't know how much attention this gets, but just you being, if you're a victim of racism, white supremacy, you say, hey, I'm going to try and do what I can to work against racism. That not just has an impact on you, that has an impact on other people that are around you, because racists, they do that a lot. They will say, well, oh, we're upset with, you know, this nigger, so that means, you know, we got to retaliate and get this nigger's mother and brothers and children's and uncle and uncles and aunts and anything else, because we're not just going to practice racism against this one nigger that upset us. We'll get all of them. And maybe if we get enough of his friends and people that he or she cares about, maybe they'll stop this activity, stop plucking our nerves. That's generally the way that they function. So that, I mean, just hearing the details, you know, explicit details about how this terrorized the entire King family over generations, and the Scott family as well. Wow. I will stop there. I think we even might have had people who had additional commentary, but it's a lot to cover, and we already did our 3 hours. We'll pick up there next week. We're still in chapter 16, so there'll be more to come. I also thought that was a great artistic move, if that's what it was, to show the transition in the text, to have Felicia Rashad come in, as this is going to be more focused on Coretta Scott King and what she's doing, and not so much her being there to support Dr. King. I think that's a great switch as well. But yeah, that'll be great if she's Felicia Rashad is the one who takes us home for the remainder of the narrative. If you have questions, commentary, you want to drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. Looking forward to being here next week. We'll be here tomorrow for the compensatory call-in. We'll also be here on Sunday. Sabrina Johnson will be here. She coordinated the memorial last month for Dr. Frances Cress Welsing. We'll talk about that, as well as her continuing work with the Welsing Institute. Normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Thanks, everyone, for participating in the broadcast. I hope it was worthy of your time and energy. Again, I will say sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy, in my opinion. Weather is getting warmer. No doubt folks want to go outside and, you know, have a good time. I want to go outside. I did that today. It was great. However, that does not mean that racists take a break just because the weather is nice. They most certainly don't. It is my opinion, if you're going to go out, do any of that, having fun, going to the beach, whatever else, you want to make sure that you are codified. That should include being sober. It's been my experience. Non-white people, cigarettes, alcohol, cannabis, any other narcotics, poisons that racists concoct, they do not help us solve the problem of white supremacy. If anything, it can make it way easier for racists to terrorize us. So just keep that in mind. Have your fun. Stay codified. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
Problem. A victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.